The House Redistricting Committee for August 25th is called to order. Thank you so much for coming. And we will be going to 5 o'clock and then recessing till 7 o'clock and starting again till 9 o'clock. Mr. Borsari, will you please call the roll of the committee members?
Absolutely. Chair Murphy?
Here.
Vice Chair Cleburne?
Present.
Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Garofalo? Representative Garofalo? Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Igo?
Present.
Representative Lee? Representative Lee? Representative Long? Representative Long? Representative Munson?
Munson, present.
Representative Nash? Representative Nash. Representative Brindley is excused.
Present.
Hello. Welcome.
I'm excused from this evening's.
My apologies. Welcome.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Sanstead.
Present.
Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz?
Present.
Welcome. Representative Stevenson?
Present.
Representative Vang? Representative Vang?
Here.
Representative West?
Present.
Representative Garofalo?
Present.
And then Representative Lee?
He's excused.
Okay, perfect. Madam Chair, a quorum is
Nash possible. Present.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I heard Nash is present.
Oh, and I marked him as well. And a quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borsari. And please note if anyone else comes in and note that for the future. We have another full agenda today, and we will spend a lot of time listening today. And as I said, we will take a break between 5 and 7. And then come back. But we are going to start today with testimony from two of the ethnic councils that were available for today's hearing. And then we will continue to work to try to get the two other ethnic councils back on the agenda in the future. First, we welcome Rosa Tok, the executive director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Welcome, Ms. Tok.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rosa Tok, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. First of all, let me start by saying that the Latino Council is very honored to testify before this committee. This is a historic opportunity that only happens once every 10 years, at a pivotal time when our nation and our state are becoming more diverse, multicultural, and multiracial. As a state agency tasked to work for the implementation of the economic, social, legal, and political equality of Latino Minnesotans, we believe that democracy is strengthened when all voices can participate and now reflected in the redistricting process. We have a unique opportunity this year to make sure that every Minnesotan is fairly represented in new district maps and that this process is transparent, providing the public with meaningful and accessible opportunities to engage and be heard. This also requires making sure that the information is also available in other languages like Spanish and accessible to Latinos and others with disabilities. Secondly, the council and our community are not surprised that the 2020 census redistricting data show that the Latino population continues to grow in the nation and in Minnesota. Now we know that Latinos are 62.1 million strong in the United States, representing 19% of the total US population. We are the nation's second largest population group. In Minnesota, we have grown 38% since the last decennial census, outpacing the state's growth of 7.6%. And Minnesota Latinos grew more than the Latino population in the US, which grew by 23%. In the North Star State, we are now 345,640 Latino Minnesotans, representing 6.1% of the total population. Last week, the state demographer Susan Brower showed to this committee a map of where we live. Though concentrated in the metro area, the suburbs and regions of central and southern Minnesota, after the white population, we are the second population group in terms of prevalence in the state. There is a growing Latino population in at least 37 counties, although we know that Minnesotans of Latino heritage live in every county. Mrs. Brower also indicated that the main factor driving Minnesota's overall population growth is not international or domestic migration, but birth, very likely from racially diverse Minnesota families, since we know now that the white population is declining. Latinos consider Minnesota their home. We work, study, play, worship, vote, and pay taxes in all corners of the state. We have a stake in the communities where we live, and we want a better future for our children. We are not only talking about first-generation immigrants, such as myself, but especially about second, third, fourth, and fifth-generation Latinos who keep contributing to the economic vitality of the state, but also to the political strength and representation of Minnesota. The Latino population growth is very likely one of the main factors behind Minnesota having kept 8 congressional seats. All of this evidence means that policymakers and those who are drawing the new legislative and congressional district maps have the responsibility to make conscious and intentional decisions using a Latino lens and Latino perspectives. I know that today's testimonies will focus on congressional districts 4 and 5, but I wanted to share with you that 2 weeks ago, our council visited Red Wing in Woodhue County to listen to the experiences of some of our constituents. Although we didn't talk about redistricting and mapping, we learned about their interests and what they value. These residents, for instance, value their parks, the outdoors, the safety they feel in Red Wing. They particularly noted the many strong bonds that unite them as Latinos through their families, their service providers, their churches, their leaders, or the nonprofits that support them with programming and services. They express that they feel part of Red Wing, but they share with us how they could become even better integrated into the community where they live. Specifically, they are interested in removing barriers to accessing health clinics. They lack public transit to bring their kids to school and back. They identify the need for more diverse and bilingual staff in schools and other public settings. They show the desire to work with decision makers at the local and state level. The council understands that we cannot generalize and draw conclusions from one town or community to draw the lines. But this is just one of a myriad of authentic examples of how the redistricting process needs to genuinely respect our community's aspirations and interests, keeping them compact in compliance with the redistricting principles of protection of racial, ethnic, and language minority groups, and preserving communities of interest. In keeping with these principles, Latinos seek an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice that understand their needs and deliver in ways that reduce the racial inequities that are still an obstacle for too many in order to reach their full potential. Also, it will be important to prioritize unity over division, guaranteeing that communities that share the same jurisdiction and interests are kept together. Slicing and dividing is confusing for districts and weakens minority communities. Over the next weeks and months, both the legislature and the courts will have a chance to hear directly from a multitude of communities, some with competing interests, others with interests that will intersect in many different ways, by occupation, location, economic activity, language, etc. In the end, we ask that the new lines are drawn in compliance with the U.S. Constitution and the Voting Rights Act and its prohibition of vote dilution as top criteria, while respecting our communities of interest. The Council will join you as we listen and understand those issues better. All along this process, please consider the Council as a resource to help you connect and understand Latino stories as these maps are envisioned. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Stock, Director of the Latino Council on Latino Affairs, which is established to advise the legislature on when before they make decisions. And your comprehensive presentation and your courageous presentation by being the number one person to come before us for representing any group or any people in these listening sessions was very, very helpful to us. And we will get back to you as the director of the council and ask for more advice as we go along. And questions are raised by our members about the things that we are hearing in these listening sessions. So thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any hands up?
No, there are not, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. The second person on on the agenda today, representing the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, is Dan Cunha.
Madam Chair, it's yes. Anjali Cameron.
Oh.
Dan is not until later.
Oh, okay. Anjali Camara, Research Director of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to comment on the redistricting process and recognizing that the impact that the decisions you make will have on our cultural communities for the next decade and beyond. Once again, for the record, my name is Anjali Cameron, and I am Research Director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I do want to echo the comments shared by Ms. Rosa Tak from the Latino Council on how critical this is for our cultural communities as we move into the redistricting process. So I've prepared a brief PowerPoint just to go over some key demographics of our community. I'll share my screen now. So the purpose of my comments today will be to inform you on the current state of Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and it's meant to highlight specific data that demonstrates the complexity you should consider when examining communities of interest. This is only scratching the surface, and in addition to the hearing process that is ongoing, I hope that when you hear public testimony from our API community members, that you carefully consider these voices in your final map making. We believe communities of interest should be widely defined depending on the needs of specific communities that make up the rich diversity within our state. Redistricting is foundational to our democracy. We strongly encourage this committee to participate in this process and make sure that it is transparent, accessible, and as accountable as possible, and to prioritize communities of interest above political concerns. So the Council of Asia Pacific Minnesotans represents more than 40 distinct nationalities and many more subgroups within these nationalities. During the 2020 census, we counted 367,000 Minnesotans who identified as having Asian Indo-Pacific Islander ancestry. You can see on the graph on the left how this is broken down between various ethnic groups, including our 10 largest ancestry groups. These distinctions between ethnicities are critical and should be understood when considering communities of interest within the API community. These ethnic, geographic, and socioeconomic distinctions between Asian and Pacific Islander groups help provide context for where we see diverging identities and shared community interests in API populations. One of the very unique aspects of Asian Pacific populations in Minnesota compared to other states is that we have a majority refugee experience community. And what I mean by that is our Hmong, Vietnamese, Lao, Cambodian, and Karen and Karenee communities came to the United States as refugees. Their needs as communities look very different from those who historically arrived as immigrants in the Asian, Indian, Chinese, Korean, and Japanese communities, for example. Asian Pacific Minnesotans are also younger. This is a point made by both demographer Brower and executive director Talk, like many other communities of color. So the redistricting process represents decisions that will impact the lives of the one-third of Asian Pacific Minnesotans who are under the age of 18 currently. There have also been some major demographic shifts within our API community since 2010, including the significant growth of the Karen and Karenee communities, who are new refugees from Burma. They are identified as Burmese on the census, and you'll note that on the graph that I'm showing. And also the growth of our two largest API communities, the Hmong and the Asian Indian. These shifts in population also represent the shifts of specific needs within geographic subdivisions of our state based on where these communities are located. So one of the critical issues in understanding Asian Pacific Minnesotans includes understanding the cultural and linguistic barriers that have prevented community participation in the democratic process historically. A significant barrier that exists for our refugee experience communities remains language access, which you can see from this graph, the difference in communities that speak English less than very well. This is important not only for the final maps that the committee produces, but also the process itself. As I mentioned earlier, the Karen community and other new refugee communities have experienced significant growth within the last decade across our state. And it's critical that both limited English proficient members of our largest community, the Hmong, and our least English proficient community, you can see 80% of the Karen Karenee community is limited English proficient, have the ability to engage in this process. It's for that reason that we at the council would ask the committee include, to the extent possible, translated materials on redistricting for the Hmong and Karen communities and as much plain language material as can be provided so that it is accessible to these community members and others who want to participate in this democratic process. Here on this map, you can see the overall density of the Asian Pacific Minnesotan population throughout the state. The highest concentration is here in the metro, but we continue to see growth in suburban and greater Minnesota as well. The lived experiences of our refugee communities may translate into different priority areas for these communities. And these significant differences are important when you're undertaking the mapping process because they are located in different geographic locations and then respond and will need to be able to respond dynamically to the disparate needs of these API communities. For example, the needs of our Asian and Indian and Chinese communities in the southwest suburbs will look very different from our Hmong Karen communities on the east side of St. Paul and our Lao families in Minneapolis. Those needs will look very different from our Cambodian and Karen families in Worthington. Statewide, we've seen a 50% growth in the last decade of the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community. Hennepin and Ramsey counties remain the largest concentration of our population, followed by Dakota, Washington, and Anoka counties. They're also followed by Scott, Olmsted, Mauer, and Carver counties, which have approximately equivalent sizes of API residents. So the biggest question is, where is the growth since the last census? And here you can see the major shifts in the population. As has been mentioned in the past, these shifts in population are percent change, so you'll see a bigger shift in Greater Minnesota because those populations started out smaller. And one other thing to note is that the census does report Asians separately from Pacific Islander, which is why you see two different maps before you since the last 2010 decennial census. For the API community, we've seen growth in our refugee experience and Pacific Islander communities in Greater Minnesota as more manufacturing and meatpacking jobs have become available. This represents a priority and a community of interest that we would like you to note. The counties that have seen the largest growth are Traverse, Swift, Freeborn, and Mauer in Greater Minnesota. Freeborn and Mauer in particular have seen significant growth from our newer refugee communities, which is why I highlighted those communities for you earlier. These communities are drawn by more jobs to these locations. The new district map should reflect the growing and shifting nature of our API populations across the state. Finally, I would be remiss if I did not mention the incredible work of our API community during the 2020 census. They were able to pivot quickly during the pandemic, and we owe them a debt of gratitude in ensuring that all Minnesotans were counted and that we retained that 8th congressional seat. So in closing, Madam Chair and members, as the advisor to you on behalf of Minnesota's Asian Pacific community, our council is prepared to assist you as appropriate and as you deem necessary in the coming weeks as you put together maps that reflect the current and ongoing needs of our communities. We ask that you also provide additional opportunities for communities of interest to engage with the legislature throughout the process, including accepting public comment after maps are drawn, and that this be an iterative and collaborative process with the communities of interest across our state. Thank you again, and I'll stand for any members' questions.
Oh, Ms. Cameron, you've been busy in the last week since we've received the data, and we appreciate that busyness a great deal. Representative Bonner has a question.
More of a comment than a question. I want to thank Anjali for all of her work with the API community. In Maple Grove, of course, we are so proud to be the largest Mendeer in all of the Midwest and be home to the Mendeer, but also to have such fabulous work in our communities. And I know Anjali personally has worked extremely hard to really represent that community and to get the word out across the state about the hard work that they do. And so I just want to thank you for your time today and for putting together all this really great information for us. It's really, really helpful for us as we embark on this journey. So thank you for that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Cameron. And we will accept your invitation to ask for your assistance as we go along and heed the words that you gave us, the very good advice that you gave us in your presentation. And as I said at the beginning, the two other advisory councils were not available for today, and we will continue to work with them to get a position on our agenda, because we know that they too have wise advice to give to us. Going on with this listening session from a group aspect, we are asking for testimony from public interest groups, and the people that came forth, we have three items on our agenda of groups that came forth to give us advice today. And the first is Nick Harper from the League of Women Voters Minnesota. Mr. Harper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nick Harper. I'm the Civic Engagement Director for the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for being here today, especially since it is not during session or even a special session. I know that you're outside of session, so thank you so much for making time to be here and listen to members of Minnesota about the redistricting process. Members, you should have a handout distributed by the committee administrator. There's two general themes in that handout. The first is a discussion of compactness related to other principles, and the second is discussing the importance of communities of interest. I'm going to start with the first one about compactness, and there's two points in there that I want to point out. You know, Representative Torkelson at the hearing last week made some excellent points about how he would like to see the redistricting process go. So the first one he mentioned that is that he would like to see the committee start by drawing house maps first, house districts first, and then combining those house districts into Senate seats. The League doesn't have a position on whether that's the right way to go, whether you should start with Senate maps and then move the House maps or vice versa. What I will say, however, is that we do know that if you draw House districts first, it will make it more difficult to create compact Senate districts, because having two compact House districts combined will not necessarily lead to a compact Senate district. So the extreme example of that is you could imagine having two perfectly compact circle districts next to each other. A circle is will score highly on compactness scores for the compactness tests. But when you combine those circles together into a single district, kind of like a figure eight or a Venn diagram type shape, because it's so indented, that will actually cause it to be lower on the compactness test. So, you know, again, we don't really have a comment on which way is the right way to do it, but if you're valuing compactness, it will make it much more difficult to start with house maps. The second piece is that Representative Torkelson and other members of the committee made an excellent point that preservation of political subdivisions, and the League also believes that preservation of political subdivisions is an important principle that should be considered. We do want to point out, though, that compactness is not always your friend when you're trying to preserve political subdivisions, and that sometimes compactness will require that political subdivisions are split. So specifically, Representative Torkelson spoke about the Senate districts in his area and that they split counties. Specifically, I think he was talking about Lyon and Redwood counties. I actually went back, and I apologize, members, that you don't have this in your packet. I will be sending it to the committee administrator after this hearing. But I actually went back to the 2010 census data and tested if there was a way to create those two Senate districts in a way that would split fewer political subdivisions while being the same or lesser population deviance. And the only way to do that would be to increase decrease the compactness of some of those districts. And I see there is a hand up, and I'm happy to stop and take a question or a comment.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Having my name called out numerous times, I thought maybe I should interject. By the way, the reason I'm interjecting is I was talking about Watonwan County, which is actually not in my district, but it does contain my hometown. That's a longer, more complicated story. But that particular county has been sliced and diced a different way every 10 years since 1972, I believe, I don't know because I haven't examined the redistricting process for each of those decades, but I believe there may have been an opportunity somewhere in those many years to have kept that county whole. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the testimony today from the League of Women Voters.
Mr. Harper.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson, for that clarification. I very much appreciate that. And you're right, many of the counties have been split repeatedly over the years, over the decades. You know, I actually went down and spoke to our New Ulm Area League in January of this year and January of last year, and had that comment come from folks both times I visited that when we talked about redistricting was that, wow, counties keep getting split out here. Why is that? Is there a way we can prevent that? So I appreciate that you have brought up and focused on the desire not to split those political subdivisions, because that is definitely something voters are concerned about, is when they see maps that do split political subdivisions. So our comment is just that compactness sometimes makes that impossible. So that's just something you should consider when establishing your principles. The second part is, in general, just with communities of interest, how important it is to keep those in the front of your minds when you're doing the redistricting process. There's many reasons to keep them in mind. I mean, it is a traditional redistricting principle in Minnesota. It's been used many times before. And on the back of that handout, we actually have some specific examples of what's been used in Minnesota specifically, just so you can get a tangible example, so to speak, of some of those might be. And sometimes there's a conversation of, you know, communities of interest being, in conflict with political subdivisions. And sometimes that is the case, but I would like to emphasize to members, it's not always the case. And sometimes you're using communities of interest to determine which political subdivisions to pair together. So maybe you're not splitting a political subdivision, but you're trying to decide which political subdivisions to put together. Should this town go with these other towns, or should this town go with these other towns? Should this county be part of this district, or should this county be part of this district? It may be that you don't have to split any of them, but you do have to make a decision on which one will go inside the district. And communities of interest can help you do that. So it is a tool that will make your jobs easier in making a map that is more representative of voters' interests. It can actually make legislators' jobs easier because they have a few clear interests in their district that they represent, rather than multiple conflicting interests. And you know, also as I'm sure. As has been mentioned, communities of interest is really the place where Minnesotans can participate in the redistricting process and help draw our maps. So, you know, compactness is a very mathematical principle. So is population equality. But communities of interest really gives an opportunity for Minnesotans to participate in the process, which also increases the likelihood that they'll see the resulting maps as something that they helped create, and something that is politically legitimate because it, you know, the people helped form and create those plans. Communities of interest is incredibly important in this process, and I would encourage members to continue keeping that in the front of their minds. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your time and members. If any members have any questions, always here and available for those questions.
Mr. Harper, are you using a particular definition for communities of interest?
There are multiple definitions that are given, you know, depending on the state. I believe Mr. Gehring has reviewed with the committee members some of the different definitions that other states have used. Okay. And I know that there are differing definitions among some of the current legislation introduced. In general, I think that it's important to remember that a community of interest is defined by the community that seeks to be heard and represented. So it would be the definition of what that community is and what is important really comes from the voters. And what those voters see is important to that community.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We do have something a little bit later on a definition of communities of interest. And Ms. Burt supplied us with the definition that the National Council of State Legislatures Wendy and Underhill gave to us. And I would divert from my agenda for that right now if you would like to listen to that definition and comment, or if you would like to listen to that definition and think about it.
If Madam Chair would like to get a specific response on that definition, I'm happy to hear or read it and try to give some feedback on it or comment.
Okay, Ms. Burt, do you have that definition before you?
Madam Chair, let me pull it up. I will let you know when I have it in front of me.
Okay. Well, I have it in front of me.
All right, why don't you go ahead and share that?
All right.
Thank you.
Wendy Underhill of National Council of State Legislature. I am quoting from her remarks at the Redistricting Law 2020 guide in the book that all of our members have available to them. Communities of interest, geographical areas such as neighborhoods of a city or regions of a state where the residents have common demographic or political interests that do not necessarily coincide with the boundaries of a political subdivision, such as a city or a county, unquote. Mr. Harper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that does describe what a community of interest is. I do think it often is helpful to clarify what types of interests you're really talking about. So I know, for example, that in some draft legislation that's been introduced, a community of interest cannot be a relationship to a political party. So that's maybe a type of clarification that might be important to members. Community of interest, either in Minnesota or in other states, have also been economic, which you could say is a political interest or a demographic interest, but there's maybe some debate there. So it might be helpful to just clarify with some additional information to really get at what you're talking about, so that members of the public understand what the principle is, members of the committee, et cetera, just so that everyone's on the same page.
Good. Thank you for your response and reaction that put you in a bad spot right there, but you just were so intriguing to me about the communities of interest, and it's so vitally important to you. And so I wanted to have a reaction at this time, but we will be back in touch with you probably many times on the communities of interest advice that you have given us. And you certainly have examples, and we appreciate that you are tuned into our meetings, and not just this meeting or last meeting, but I bet you're going to be attentive to all of our meetings. And we appreciate that, because we know that League of Women Voters are across the state. And we've received lots of postcards from the League of Women Voters around the state of Minnesota. And they have their individual comments on them that we take very seriously. And another word that we don't have, we have many definitions contained within it, and we use it over and over, the members of this committee use it over and over, that we have to pay a little more attention to is fair. Everybody that comes or thinks about redistricting wants a fair redistricting map.
Yeah. But yes, that is correct, Madam Chair. And I know that, if I may, for some folks, fair is difficult to define, and that's true. But I think that there are certain ground rules that everyone can agree to, and that is a great starting point for determining what is fair across the state. Even if it is difficult and each person might see fairness slightly differently, I think there are generally some pretty similar ground rules that we all agree to. And I know that the committee will strive towards meeting that. So thank you so much again, Madam Chair, for your time, for allowing me to speak today.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Harper. Now, Ms. Conley, is it time for Dan to come up?
Yes, it is.
Okay. The representative of Common Cause Minnesota, Dan Vicuna.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dan Vicuna. I'm testifying on behalf of Common Cause Minnesota, as the chair mentioned. Apologies for the last minute change. Our state executive director, Anastasia Baldona Carrera, is out of the country and experiencing some internet connection issues, something we can all understand in this pandemic era. So I'm I'm Common Cause's national redistricting manager. I'm going to do my best to fill her capable shoes. So Common Cause Minnesota is a nonpartisan grassroots organization. We have almost 21,000 multi-partisan members, allies, and supporters statewide. For the past 5 years, we've advocated for and mobilized around grassroots, nonpartisan, and voter-focused redistricting reforms that put the redistricting process in the hands of a bipartisan citizen redistricting committee. We are proud that the bulk of HF 2594 remains the only bill that is reflective of statewide grassroots input. It's the culmination of 3 years of meetings and recommendations from both sides of the aisle and both chambers, without the input and feedback supporting the work or challenging us with other ideas from members such as Representatives Brindley, Nash, Zerwas, Bernardi, Senators Benson and Curran, to name a few, it would not have been possible to put this bill together. Representative Cleavorn's leadership on HF 2594 is, of course, exemplary. We've partnered with grassroots organizations to educate Minnesotans across the state on what redistricting is, why it's important, and how it impacts them. We've met with dozens of grassroots organizations, local chambers of commerce, and rotary clubs. We've knocked on doors and talked with Minnesotans at county fairs, farmers markets, and local special events. We've been everywhere. A resounding theme coming out of these outreach efforts is a demand to put the people first in the redistricting process and to maximize transparency and political accountability to constituents. Redistricting is an important democracy tool that impacts how Minnesotans' issues are represented and how their voices are heard. We encourage this committee to hold a transparent, highly engaging, and accessible process that allows Minnesotans to provide input on proposed maps before they're finalized, not after the fact. Also, access to information about any non-public discussions of redistricting between decision makers should be made available to the public. There are several consistent themes that rose to the top when we spoke to Minnesotans about the things they want this committee to consider in drafting redistricting principles. We've provided these in some more detail in written form, but I'm going to sort of highlight them briefly here. We've learned that Minnesotans feel strongly that keeping communities of interest together is essential to successful redistricting. Referencing the previous discussion, I'll say that the bill I mentioned earlier has a pretty expansive definition. We really think that's the key. For that definition to be both expansive and driven by the public feedback. We believe that preserving the cores of districts should be absent from or low on the list of redistricting priorities, because we think that keeping communities together as they are reflected by current census data and public input should be the priority, prioritized over preserving a pre-existing status quo. Consistent with this view about prioritizing keeping communities of interest together, we also believe that we should place no emphasis on protecting incumbents from being paired in the same district with each other. Those we spoke to also believe that counting imprisoned people where they are imprisoned unfairly distorts population totals, and that imprisoned people should be counted for redistricting at their last pre-incarceration address. We want to address the issue of prison gerrymandering. We also believe that defending the rights of racial, ethnic, and language minorities in the redistricting process is, of course, essential. We believe that American Indian communities should be treated as political subdivisions and communities of interest. And finally, our outreach to Minnesotans across the state strengthened our belief that compliance with the letter and the spirit of the Federal Voting Rights Act and its prohibition of vote dilution and of retrogression must remain a primary consideration in redistricting. We believe that HF 2594 meets each of these goals best. It best ensures fair district maps for all Minnesotans, regardless of partisan affiliations, zip codes, or socioeconomic backgrounds, while minimizing wiggle room for partisanship to seep through. So we ask that you apply the principles, process, and transparency outlined in HF 2594. Thank you in advance for working to make sure fair representation for Minnesotans is prioritized first ahead of party, self, and special interests. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Ms. Greenman, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question on the last piece you talked about folks who are incarcerated being represented at the place that they last lived. And I'm wondering, I know that there are states that have done it, that are doing that in other places, but I'm wondering if you have any information on how sort of the best way to collect that data, given that the census doesn't collect it, if there's best practices from other states that are doing that.
Yeah, there actually are some best practices that we've learned, in just the last cycle. Only two states did this, but then this year, I think we're up to 9 states that have passed legislation to do this. And it's a much simpler than I think it sounds. Initially, Common Cause just produced a kind of white paper with the Prison Policy Initiative to demonstrate just that, how to go about that. I think probably rather than me trying to kind of lay it out, I'll send that resource along to the committee and hopefully that's helpful, but we're also happy to connect folks with experts from other states that have done this and with, with a little difficulty.
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or reaction advice? Thank you so much, Mr. Vicuña, and we appreciate your advice, and we really appreciate organization that Common Cause, if you've been working at this for 2 years with people across the state of Minnesota, you've obviously been aware that new maps were going to be drawn, and you would have the opportunity to give us advice and weigh in on how the final maps are drawn. And I'm sure you want reaction after they are drawn, as previous persons that have spoken today have advised also. And so we appreciate that you've done this forethought that lays the groundwork for us to begin with the current data that we received last week. And we appreciate your efforts, and we will continue to appreciate your efforts as we proceed along the journey to produce maps for the state of Minnesota that are all the things that you want it to be.
Well, thank you so much for your time. One quick note. The resource I mentioned on reversing prison gerrymandering, is that the link to that is actually in our written materials. So I just want to add that. Thank you.
I will look at that because I have a prison in my current district and probably in my next district too, because it's only 2 miles away. So thank you. Thank you very much. The last person on our agenda for the public interest groups that have volunteered to come before us today is George Beck from Clean Elections Minnesota. Oh, Representative Tarkelson before Mr. Clark or Beck.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping that Mr. Vicuña might still be available for a quick question.
I bet he is. Mr. Vicuña?
I am, yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. In the House file that you mentioned, House File 2594, it advocates for a 5% deviation in district population. Does Common Cause support that position?
I wouldn't say that we have a particularly strict view on population deviation. I think what we have seen around the country is that a large population deviation can be used for good or ill, and so can a very tight one. I think our view is primarily driven by, I think, qualitative input on whether communities are kept together and whether a larger deviation is necessary to do that. I guess our one strong position is that we would certainly choose keeping communities of interest together over a tight population deviation. I don't know that we've exactly settled on a particularly kind of hard number, although yeah, we do think that 5 is acceptable, and that's why we supported it in the bill.
Do you have a position about 1 or 2%?
I don't think we have a particularly strong one. We're sort of developing it. I think we want to see how some of the redistricting data after it's processed shakes out, where people live, and whether a smaller deviation can be used and still keep some of those communities together. So at this point, I think I'd say we're still kind of developing it.
Thank you. Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the testimony of Common Cause and the good community outreach that you've done in helping to prepare this bill for introduction. I just want to share with the committee the conversations that were had regarding that deviation. The bill, as I stated earlier in our previously public committee meeting, the deviation of 5% is maybe larger than we would have wanted to introduce in the bill. But at that time, because it was a grassroots bill and it had many, many stakeholders involved, the agreement was we would go larger, and then as the bill came closer to committee, there would be an opportunity to add an author's amendment to make it a little tighter. At this moment, it is my understanding that the larger group is looking more to 2% or less. But as I said, and as our testifier has stated today, this is an ongoing conversation, and I would welcome further comments at another committee if individuals have different opinions. So thank you very much. The idea is that communities of interest, as our testifier has stated, that communities of interest not be hampered by a small deviation or too small of a deviation.
Thank you. And I'm sure this isn't the end of the conversation, because Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. A question for Mr. Vicuña as well. I am interested if Common Cause has a position on where incarcerated persons should be counted.
Yes, we believe that incarcerated persons should be counted at their previous known address, not in the location of the where they're imprisoned.
Thank you.
Any other hands? Last chance. Mr. Beck is waiting. Thank you very much, Mr. Vicuña. We appreciate it. Mr. Beck?
Madam Chair, members, my name is George Beck, and I chair Clean Elections Minnesota. Few things are more important to democracy than a fair redistricting process, and the evidence of that, unfortunately, is our sister state, Wisconsin, which is one of the most gerrymandered states in our nation due to the manipulation of voting districts by one political party. That's what we have to avoid in the state of Minnesota. And principles to govern map drawing are crucial to a fair process. My group, a nonpartisan nonprofit, supports the adoption of House File 2594, sponsored by Representative Cleaborn. The bill will leave less room for partisan agendas as principles are applied and maps are drawn. In other words, these principles are voter focused and put Minnesota voters first. This bill reflects grassroots input. Crucially, districts must not be drawn to favor or disfavor a political party, candidate, or incumbent. Location of the residences of incumbents or candidates must not be considered. And it's important that the public be afforded meaningful input into the drawing of the maps. This bill provides for a detailed report that will provide full disclosure of the activities and judgments involved in determining the legislative and congressional districts. And this is important to be responsible to the people of our state. The bill would maximize the opportunity for transparency and accountability in drawing maps. And these policies, I don't think, should be left to an ad hoc process by our Supreme Court as it has in the past. The legislature ought to have some input into that. I also wanted to mention that we support the direct participation of public members on a commission, which will minimize a partisan agenda. Hopefully, some of that might be accomplished next year. The people of Minnesota fully recognize the conflict of interest involved in legislators picking their own districts. What we want is an open, honest, and fair process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Beck. Did you identify where you live?
I live in St. Louis Park, Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Thank you for your advice, and I'm sure you're going to be monitoring our behavior of this committee as we proceed in our open meetings and our meetings that are public.
Of course, thank you.
And we intend for openness and public meetings throughout the process. Also, anyone that wants to give us advice in writing, on our committee website are the directions for contacting us and for submitting written testimony. And Ms. Sarah Burt is our analyst that is sole purpose at this time is redistricting. And Nancy Conley is the committee administrator and can direct you to all kinds of assistance as we proceed along the journey for what Mr. Beck talked about with fair and open and just maps so that Minnesota is unique in all the upper Midwest, at least. Thank you, Mr. Beck. We are going now to the listening sessions from people in this, and not that the people haven't been represented through their organization and groups that have spoken before us, but individuals that wanted to participate in giving us advice on where we are. And this is the first opening session of a congressional district. And we are opening with the 5th district. And we have 15 people from the 5th district that have volunteered to give us advice in our listening session. But before we start listening to the people of the 5th District, Mr. Eric Guthrie from the state demographer's office, and he is senior demographer for the state of Minnesota. And Matt Gehring, we heard from before, who is nonpartisan House research expert on redistricting, have presented a brief overview of redistricting timelines and public what we should be considering because of the new censuses that Mr. Guthrie will talk to us about. So Mr. Guthrie and Mr. Gehring, you have a brief time period before we listen to the 15 participants from the 5th District. Is Mr. Guthrie starting the process?
I am ready to go if we would like to hear from you first.
Your face is before me.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just share my screen so that some folks can see the slides that I have prepared.
Great. We like slides.
Wonderful. Okay, so thank you very much for having me come and talk to the committee today. I sincerely appreciate it, and I appreciate the willingness to listen and to incorporate the new data into making more fair and equitable districts. I come here to talk about how the 5th District has changed since the last redistricting process, and I have just a few slides to kind of go over that, and then I will of course be willing to take any questions from anyone as they come up. So the first slide, my slides are not advancing. There we go. The first slide, I think that many of the members of the committee have already seen, and I just wanted to start off by showing where we have seen percent growths throughout the state and in the metro region as well. These are percent growths. If I were to be showing you numeric growth and declines, as our state demographer, Dr. Brower, has in the past, much of the state would be washed out in a single color, because the colors in outstate Minnesota would be the percentages the numeric changes would be not comparable to those changes we have seen in the metro area. So I wanted to start off with a view of the percent changes. We can see that there have been quite a lot of areas in the state that have had significant percent changes in population between 2010 and 2020. That does not diminish the fact that most of the growth that we have seen has occurred in the metro region. If we are to highlight District 5, we can see that all of the areas in District 5 show those positive colors, and I'm just going to zoom in so that we can get a better view of it. We can see that the entirety of the sub-district geographies, and these are all political geographies, so cities and townships and things like that, have grown over the period. The largest percent growth, I should say, has actually occurred in the unorganized territory around the airport, the unorganized Snelling territory. And while that shows a large percent growth, that was a relatively small number of persons because not a lot of people live in that particular area. There's a veterans apartment building in that area, and of course the military housing and things like that. But the interesting thing, I think, is to see that the entirety of the political jurisdictions within the district have gained population between 2010 and 2020, and that is something that is has been experienced differently than other districts throughout the state. You'll notice the scale is a little bit different. When I'm talking about percent declines, you really can only go to 100% loss, and no area in the state's really seeing that. But there is quite a bit of room to go up, and so you'll see that the scales are a little bit different. But luckily for the 5th District, all we have to really be concerned about has been growth. If we take a broader look at growth, we can see that the growth has been experienced differently if we start looking at particular groups within the district. And these data are for the 5th district. And you'll excuse me for one second. I just need to move something out of my way so I can see my screen better. There we go. We can see that most of the populations have increased. There have been some declines in some of our smaller racial groups, some of the racial groups that don't necessarily constitute a large proportion of the district. We can see that our Native American population has declined, and also our Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander population has slightly declined. I mean, the very small decline that is noted in these 2 points in time looks like a relatively large percent decline, but that is solely the effect of small numbers. The district has become more diverse, and I think that has been reflected in a lot of the testimony that we have heard today. We can see that the our African American population has increased significantly, so has our Asian population, and most notably our populations that identify as some other race or who identify as multiple racial groups have increased the most over the period. But that is not to take away from the fact that the Hispanic or Latino ethnic group has also had a quite significant increase in the 5th district between 2010 and 2020. Overall, the district has grown by about 11% between the two periods. My goal here today was to talk mostly about the shifts in population, how that has been seen between the political jurisdictions and among the racial groups, racial and ethnic groups. But I also want to just talk a little bit for a few moments about the changes in data collection practices, because I think that those are important as well. Data for the 2020 census was collected differently in a number of ways. First and foremost, we saw data collected online for the first time ever. It was also collected via a paper questionnaire. People could also respond by phone, and some people responded by having enumerators at their doors. But a very significant change this time was the ability for the additional writing in of groups beyond just our standard classification. So, even something that has not been available in the past, the white racial group was able to write in subgroups, and also there were more spaces and larger spaces for people to write in more groups that better allow them to identify themselves. And this has really allowed us to paint a better picture of how individuals see themselves, which has highlighted that we are really a more multiracial and more multi-ethnic society than previous data has been able to show. This is not necessarily a change in individual conceptions, but previous data collection practices have not really been amenable to allowing people to really express how they view themselves. Now, this is not solely responsible. I don't want to take away from the growth in communities of color, because those growths have been real and they have been seen and witnessed in the data. But we've also seen increases in the some other race category and the multiple race categories, which is indicative of people being able to better identify themselves, because many of us are not encapsulated by a single racial checkoff box that has been a method for collecting these data in the past. Additionally, when we think about the collection of the 2020 census data, we do have to remember that these data were collected during a worldwide pandemic, which required the Census Bureau to make many adjustments to their operational plans. I have to commend the Census Bureau for being nimble and being able to adjust their operational plans on the fly, and they have indicated that they were able to close out in excess of 99% of all cases. So all housing units that were part of the universe for for data collection. So given the particular challenges of this census cycle, I believe that the Bureau deserves to be commended for that particular accomplishment. We also do have to recognize that there had been unprecedented uncertainty regarding certain aspects of the census. And this was even prior to the pandemic, which caused a lot of concern with individuals' willingness to respond to the census. And the fact that the Census Bureau was able to close out the majority of cases, I think, shows how hard that they worked in order to overcome some of those apprehensions and make the case that answering the census and identifying yourself and providing a complete and thorough identification of how you view yourself was a valuable exercise in civic engagement. This something that that has been talked about in the past, and that I know that our state demographer, Dr. Brower, has mentioned to the redistricting committee as well, is that this census is the first census to implement a new disclosure avoidance system called differential privacy, which will inject noise into the census data to help protect respondents' privacy. That means that these very, very small areas, the block level geographies, are going to be a little fuzzier, perhaps, and that's the they're not going to be quite as accurate as they have been in the past. However, when you begin to aggregate those data up to higher levels of geography, those data become more and more accurate and are appropriate, and the Census Bureau has certified that they are fit for use for the redistricting use case. Those are the quick remarks that I have about the changes in the demographics and the growth in the fifth congressional districts. If anybody has any questions, I'd be more than willing to do the best I can to answer those at this point.
Great, that's a lot of information, and blue is a lovely color, and your blue just kept fading and then building and then going in the fifth district. And so we got a good impression from the maps. Thank you. I don't see any hands. Do I see any hands? If not, thank you. Mr. Gehring, is there any particular deadlines that you're going to talk about that reflect just the fifth district? On the timeline calendar and the other stuff you could hold till tonight, along with the fourth district when you do the thing for timeline. We've got only about 3 minutes.
Sure, Madam Chair. Yeah, I can hold off until the evening portion. There are no specific deadlines for any congressional district. All the deadlines apply equally across the state. So I can talk about those this evening if you'd like.
Great, because we have a lot more time tonight.
Sure.
Built in because we have fewer members of the public that have signed up to testify, so we could make up that time then, if it's okay with you. Don't want to hurt your feelings.
Madam Chair, my feelings will not be hurt.
You have to be here either way, right?
Right.
Thank you so much for being flexible. So that brings us to the first people that are the 15 people that are here, scared to death or not, because they've done it in other decades. But some of you are brand new to redistricting committee and this decade of data and this decade of listening sessions by the House Redistricting Committee. And we want to welcome you here, and we are going to be very attentive to everything you say. The first person, bold and challenging, is Larry Etkin from Minneapolis, who has also submitted written testimony. But following the guidelines that we gave, we are going to be listening to Mr. Larry Etkin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson Murphy, for the opportunity to address the committee. I'm not scared or anything. I graduate degree training was in broadcast journalism. So
all right.
Even though I never worked in that field, I'm comfortable public speaking.
Thank you so much.
Again, my name is Larry Etkin. I'm a resident of Minneapolis. I'd like to preamble what I planned as my formal remarks with a brief note that on things that I've picked up listening to other people this afternoon. I'm discouraged by the current state of districting, where at least four of our eight congressional districts pretty much guarantee that a usually poor turnout in a primary pretty much determines the election. And I've also heard a lot of that testimony today about the need for keeping communities of interest together, but I'm not personally convinced that any narrow definition of that idea should be the dominant way to go, because those are the definitions that have led to that determinant of those four congressional districts. As I said, I'm a resident of Minneapolis. I've lived continuously in Minnesota since I moved here in 1975 for graduate school. I identify myself as a mostly retired freelance editor, writer, and publications designer. I'm 69 years old, and I've been civically active since my mid-teens, back when I was growing up in New York City. I'll acknowledge in advance that what I'm about to propose will probably not be well received. I'd like to take this opportunity to suggest that while the legislature should largely follow the principles of trying to keep communities together for state legislative districts, it should not follow those past principles in redistricting for our United States congressional representatives. I advance this viewpoint because I feel that the current practice disadvantages those elected to the so-called outstate congressional districts compared to those elected in the Twin Cities metropolitan region, because there is obviously a significant travel-related burden for those representing outstate districts compared to those for the urban and suburban districts. I would instead suggest that the eight congressional districts of Minnesota be split in somewhat of a pie-shaped format, radiating out from a central point pegged squarely in the middle of Minneapolis-St. Paul. If we partition a 360-degree circle around the central point I'm suggesting, we might see, for instance, that all eight Minnesota districts can be constructed to include urban, suburban, and rural populations. One district radiating through downtown St. Paul might extend to Stillwater. Another might cut through Roseville and extend right through Duluth and include the Arrowhead region. A third could maybe cut through Brooklyn Park, extend through St. Cloud, and maybe incorporate the International Falls area. That pattern could be continued through all eight districts, providing dual benefits of somewhat evening out the amounts of physical territory each representative would need to cover to stay in touch with the communities they represent, and will likely, and this is the most important element, I think, will likely make all of the districts a lot more competitive. This in lieu of the majority of districts, as I mentioned, each currently configured to largely guarantee a DFL victor in urban districts or a Republican one in those primarily rural. I know that the kind of district structure I propose would require a lot of lines drawn right through urban and suburban neighborhoods, the practical difficulties of actually determining which blocks and maybe even which houses on a block go into each district in the scheme I propose are certainly surmountable with today's computers. They are, after all, going to be employed anyway as each party attempts to draw those lines to specifically benefit itself. My scheme would, I believe, instead benefit every Minnesotan. Again, I thank you for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions any of the members of the committee might have.
And Mr. Atkins, are you available down the road a ways as we travel?
I certainly would be available at any time.
With this pie that you're drawing out?
I haven't specifically drawn the pie. I just conceptualized how it might be. I don't have the numbers in front of me that, you know, the demographer and the committee obviously has to be able to precisely define where in that 360-degree pie the lines coming radiating out from the metropolitan area should be. But as I said, the two parties are going to be running all of these numbers through computers anyway, and they can certainly slice and dice them any way they choose to do. I strongly believe that competition, the maximum amount of competition in any electoral contest is a benefit to the people of the district where the contest is being run for. And I really dislike the fact that here in the 5th District, whoever gets the DFL nomination, as poorly attended that primary and that caucus nominating process tends to be, is guaranteed to be my representative. Same thing in District 4, and on the Republican side, same thing in several districts outstate. It just is not fair. It's that fairness test that Common Cause and several other people have mentioned just is not present in the current definition of keeping those quote unquote narrow communities of interest compact. It just isn't there. It isn't fair.
Thank you for very much. You've certainly given us some exciting things to think about.
As I said,
bringing international calls down with St. Paul or Minneapolis is just, it is intriguing. So
thank you much. And as I said, I'd be happy to address this committee or any other committee again at any point in the future more about it. And at this point, I'll sign off because I do have a couple of things I've got to do in my household right now. And
thank you so much. We appreciate your exciting testimony. Scott Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott Graham. As your chair just said, I live in Minneapolis, Senate District 61, CD5. I'd like to thank you for taking citizen input on our redistricting process. I'm pleased to speak to you today. As we witness voter suppression efforts pass through state houses throughout our country, it's especially vital that our redistricting process be a model for the rest of the nation, just as our voter turnout frequently is. Redistricting should not be a partisan process by which districts are drawn to help partisan allies, hurt political enemies, and when elected officials choose their voters before their voters choose them. It should be carried out to ensure equal voting power and fair representation. I encourage your process to consider a couple criteria that are not always utilized, specifically something that's been well mentioned today, communities of common interest. My interest here is the Iron Range, which is generally a community interest in economics. Many other common interests exist. And as Mr. Harper from the League mentioned, they're best described by those individual communities. So this is where you're taking input from voters is particularly vital. Another is consistency with natural and political boundaries, like county and municipal lines, for example. District borders that do not match these are inevitable, but they're terribly inconvenient and often unfair. They can suppress citizen engagement in activities like party caucuses and in voting. And I'd also like to mention compactness, districts that metaphorically attempt to be as close to a circle or a square as possible. This is a common criteria for redistricting, but since maps so often violate this principle, I felt like it deserves special attention in my testimony. Sometimes competitiveness is included as a criteria as well, with the goal of creating districts that will be as evenly split in two-party partisanship. My testimony is that competitiveness is a poor criterion, both because it can undermine the representation of minorities and because it requires those drawing lines to actively consider the impact of these districts on electoral outcomes. When you encounter in your process a density of a particular racial makeup or of a common interest, which because of its population could create a full district, I encourage you to explore not packing this community into a single district, but consider splitting the community between two districts so that each community can influence, so that that community can influence or even create a majority in each of those two districts. I encourage further public testimony and public hearings to create the fairest maps possible. I wish you well in your work. I'm happy to participate in any way you see fit to call me to. And again, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you.
Any comments? Thank you very much. What's your connection with the Iron Range?
None. I just was calling it out as a common interest community.
Because of the economics.
Exactly. You know, Rangers are a community. Even if they live in different cities, that's a community of interest. And they're in different counties, they're in different cities, but that's a common interest community. And I'm not suggesting it all be in one district. It certainly can't be in one House or Senate district, and it likely won't be in one congressional district, but it is an interest of common community.
I see. Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Matt Scherer from Edina.
Madam Chair, Mr. Scherer is not available.
Oh. Irene Fernando, Hennepin County Commissioner.
Is it? Yes.
Okay, here you are. I thought maybe it's too early.
No, I'm here. Thank you, Madam Chair and members
Welcome,
of the committee.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you. I'm grateful that you convened this listening session and have created opportunities for public testimony. My name is Irene Fernando, Hennepin County Commissioner for District 2, which includes Golden Valley, Medicine Lake, Minneapolis, Plymouth, and St. Anthony Village. My district and Hennepin County sit in both the 3rd and 5th Congressional Districts. I proudly chaired Hennepin County's Complete Count Committee, and in that capacity, I'm thrilled to highlight that we grew by over 11% from 2010 to 2020. Thanks to numerous government partners, community organizations, and neighborhood leaders, millions of Minnesotans completed their census forms. They overcame both the disruptive force of the COVID-19 public health emergency, as well as the fear and confusion sown by efforts at the federal level to exclude marginalized communities from the census entirely. Between the courage of our residents and the hard work of staff and volunteers, Minnesota retained all 8 of our congressional seats by a margin of just 26 people. Every single event, phone bank, language interpreter, and digital campaign mattered, and I'm hopeful that the state, counties, and cities can further invest in future census counts, especially for historically undercounted communities like North Minneapolis, where I live, because we must fund efforts to ensure every single person in our communities are counted. So now that thousands of people have participated in the census for the very first time, we have the responsibility to ensure their voices are heard in government by drawing districts that reflect that increased participation. Today, I encourage you to consider the population growth among our neighbors who identify as Black, Indigenous, and people of color in Minnesota by drawing districts that reflect the communities of interest in which they reside. I encourage you to avoid diluting the voices of our most marginalized neighbors by not splitting communities apart. A call to action for members of this committee is to make sure that communities who have experienced decades-long patterns of disinvestment and historic harms are guaranteed a full seat at the table. Our Hennepin communities, especially areas that are growing in racial diversity, economic needs, and even food supports, which should be very alarming for all of us, require increased federal investments to increase their quality of life. These investments are determined by census allocations such as education, infrastructure, healthcare, social services, transit, transportation, and more. And in order for our residents to receive their fair share of these investments, they need to be able to translate their successful census efforts to be counted into the political voice and representation we all deserve. In fact, it's more than deserved. They've earned it, as evidenced by the census results. So thank you again, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak today. You have quite a heavy lift ahead of you, and I certainly acknowledge that and wish you well and welcome any thoughts or questions as time permits.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Ms. Fernando for recognizing our census workers, not only in her district but throughout the state, and the great work they did. I think perhaps we should take some time in a later hearing to really call out some of those heroes that did all that hard work that made sure that we kept 8 congressmen instead of going backwards down to 7. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the testimony.
I think you're absolutely right, Representative Torkelson, and we should take time out at a later time and to hear from the census takers. A little bit from the census takers. They were on the ground floor.
And, that's right.
And they brought us to this point. So thank you.
And if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes. Yes,
yeah, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative, for the comment. 26 is a very small margin. I think, you know, it was 8 or 9,000 a decade prior. And so if anybody's interested in talking census 2030, I, for one, am all in because 26 is just too small of a margin, and our state has a really growing diverse set of needs. So thank you, Madam Chair and yes. Representative for the comment.
You're welcome. And thank you so much for coming, and thank you for your advice. And we will be reviewing it as we go along. Anika Robbins, might be too early.
Not at all, Madam Chair.
Okay,
you.
You're here. All
I
right.
I am here. I am present.
Please tell us who you are and where you live.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is Anika Robbins. I am the president and CEO of the Anika Foundation, former chair of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, and founder of the Black Census Table. I live and am somewhat speaking on behalf of North Minneapolis, and was very pleased to hear the comments of our Commissioner Fernando, and happy to expound on our work together.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, ma'am. Good afternoon to all of the elected public officials on the line. Too many to name, but thank you for your work around this very important work. I'm here to represent and speak on behalf of U.S.-born African-Americans in the 5th Congressional District, and indeed the broader diverse global diaspora emerging in communities across our region. This is the home of Prince, Jimmy Jam, and Terry Lewis, and the first Black, first woman mayor of Minneapolis, Sharon Sells Belton, and home to our first two women of color to serve on Hennepin County's Board of Commissioners. Our organization, the Anika Foundation, began our work roughly 2.5 years ago as part of the diverse group of community organizations that formed the Our Minnesota Census Mobilization Team. We engaged in an intense relational organizing effort statewide. We partnered with both Hennepin and Ramsey counties, the city of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and engaged several folks in Mankato, St. Cloud, Rochester, and then some. The work, as you can imagine, took a turn during the pandemic and then the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. The last thing on people's minds was voting or the census, but we pressed on, pivoting, which, mind you, became the word of the year in our service delivery. We are typically a high-touch grassroots operation, registering voters, connecting folks to essential needs, trying to engage a community by any means necessary. In the wake of these events, we see how voting and census participation are even more critical. In our recent community of interest mapping sessions that we've done as part of the RMAPS coalition, building on that collective Census 2020 work, recurring themes emerge: place, history, and connections. In the historic U.S.-born African-American community, we learn from elders what signature places, venues, and people matter to them, the churches, the various intersections such as 38th and 4th Avenue on the south side, or Penn and Broadway, you know, Lindale and Broadway, and several other, Dowling, Lowry, and many others that are critical pieces and places in our communities. We heard how in the development of Interstate I-94 disrupted the heart of community in both South Minneapolis and the historic Rondo neighborhood. And yet, despite those disruptions, elements of those communities remain. And it shows just how important those attachments are and how important it is to maintain those places. It promotes being grounded, safe, stable places to raise families, have children, attend schools, increase home ownership, promote cultural districts and connections, and access to quality education, housing, and jobs. We can see from recent events in Afghanistan how important place matters to people, no matter who you are, no matter where you are. Our asks are simple: that you keep communities of interest centered in your decision-making, because while statistics and numbers might matter to you, the average citizen, the folks that we have engaged over the past 3 years, they really have no concept of these things. All they know is where they take their children to school, their grocery store, you know, or their favorite farmer's market, their places of worship. And even though we've seen a lot of growth in these communities and how these communities have also grown to become the homes of our immigrant neighbors, our Native Americans, the Asian Pacific Islander communities, everyone has called several of the places that African Americans have historically been home to them. This is also home for them. And so as you're thinking about redrawing lines and trying to make things add up, just keep that human aspect in mind. The other things we will say again is that what matters is place, people, and connections. We would also ask that you consider ending prison gerrymandering and count prison inmates at their last known address. In Hennepin County, for instance, our jails and juvenile detention centers account for are disproportionately represented by 70% Black men and youth. And when they are released, they come back to North Minneapolis and their homes throughout Hennepin County. So that's important to count that. And we also lastly would ask that you maintain compliance to the letter and spirit of the Federal Voting Rights Act and its prohibition of vote dilution, retrogression, and must remain a primary consideration in redistricting. And I'm citing from a statement from Common Cause, who we're also in partnership with. So as you can see, what matters is community. And that's the voice that I wanted to come and lift up today. Many of our community members are not engaged at this level. They don't know that this meeting is happening now because they themselves are at work, right? So I'm here standing in that gap. We have partnered with the NAACP, Minneapolis Urban League, and several other community-based organizations. And so we ask that you please give consideration to those voices and those folks who do not have the time to come and present as I have. And lastly, I want to give a shout out to Commissioner Fernando and to Samantha Vang and Representative Jamie Long and some other familiar faces, Representative Jenny Claiborne and others who I've had the opportunity to meet, Nick and Julie and several others. Thank you again for this opportunity to address this committee, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your good advice and for your thoughts about community and place and people. Samantha Vang, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Ms. Anigo Robbins. It's good to see you. It's been a good minute. I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but if you can, please go ahead. Perhaps maybe staff might know this question. Regarding the prison population, when you know, folks were taking the census, wasn't there an option for the prison population to count themselves back at their last known address? Was that already input in the data when they were taking the census? I'm not sure.
Mr. Gehring, can you answer that?
Madam Chair, Representative Vang, I'm not familiar with that allowance, but I'd have to take a deeper look at the census form just to verify that. I can certainly look at it and get back to you.
Thank you.
The standard practice for the census is that they do count inmates within the facility that they're located in.
Mr. Guthrie?
Yes. So I would like to just, the question was, could people in prisons self-identify at their last known? The prisons are not counted the way that housing units are counted. Prisons are considered group quarters units, and generally inmates are responded for by the facility themselves. And no, those data about their previous known addresses are not collected as part of the census process.
Thank you, Miss. Thank you. Thank you, Anika Robbins, and we'll probably be seeing you again as we go along our journey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next person is Blanca Martinez Galvina from Richfield. Or maybe not from Richfield, but Ms. Galvina?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can.
Okay, perfect.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and where you're from.
Hi. Yes, thank you. My name is Blanca Martinez Gaviña. I live in the city of Minneapolis, South Minneapolis, but today I'm at that capacity with representing or Mayor Maria Reagan Gonzalez from the city of Richfield. And I am also the equity administrator here for the city of Richfield. So thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to speak on behalf of our community. So I just wanted to start by giving you all a little bit of a snapshot of who we are here in the city of Richfield. In case you didn't know, the city of Richfield is the oldest suburb in the Twin Cities. We really do pride ourselves as the urban hometown. We are small geographically, we're only 7 square miles. And in this, in all of this, in our history, we just cannot afford to be split. Our core services, who we are, our entity is one Richfield, and our planning or and our overall investments are very much tied to this identity. During the 2020 census, in partnership with many of the census workers and state demographer's office and many of our resident volunteers, we worked tirelessly to make sure that everyone was counted. Everyone in our community, especially those historically excluded members of our community, to ensure that everyone had the access to the education, the healthcare, and the transportation that they deserve. And as you know, in 2020, Richfield, here in the city of Richfield, we had a very significant growth. We had an increase of 42% in our BIPOC community, especially in the Black and the Latino Latinx community, which is a total of 41% of our population. But despite this increase, we do know that within BIPOC communities, the Latino community, Latinx community, was definitely undercounted. And it is incredibly important that we continue to keep this, as Ms. Annika said, keep the human center perspective and ensure that the voices are heard and that they're represented equitably in our government. Because especially for the Latinx or Latino community, Richfield does have the reputation as a city to be a safe space. 66 in the 66th Street, which is a pivotal part, a cultural corridor in the Latino community, is known as La 66, which is the 66. So it's critical to understand that importance of keeping our community together. Again, under the leadership of our mayor, Reagan Gonzalez, and our city leadership, we continue to keep Richfield in the public eye. This can sometimes be a challenge. We are small, but we are mighty. And we just want to make sure that you understand that if we are split, if our community is split, we do lose some of that power. And it's simply critical to be aware that in this redistricting process, we don't hurt our community and we're not divided, especially those that have been historically excluded. And just lastly, I just want to just really hone in on the fact that we are, the way that we plan, the way that we look into the future, we look as to the city as a whole.
We can't hear you. Ms. Blanca or Ms. Gavina, we can't hear you. I can't hear you.
Perhaps we could go on, Madam Chair.
Okay. She didn't hear me. What, does anybody hear me?
Yes, Chair Murphy, we can hear you. Might I suggest that we send her a text and then let her know if we have her contact number? Oh, good.
Are you able to hear me?
Now we are, but we didn't hear for the last bit, but now your time is up. But we heard you say that you don't want Richfield to be split.
Yes, thank you for that.
Thank you
so much for your time.
Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for stepping in. We appreciate that, too.
Thank you.
Susan Mabira? Nope. Oh. We might be too early. You are here? Okay.
Yes, I am. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Tell us your name and that you're from Brooklyn Park, and proceed as you wish.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. Hi, everyone. My name, I'm Susan Mabera. I'm originally from Kenya, East African community. I have lived in Brooklyn Park for the past 9 years, and I'm here speaking on behalf of African immigrants and from a diverse community in Brooklyn Park. I was involved with the census because I wanted to make sure everyone was counted, especially people of color who have been historically undercounted. So my community has the resources it needs for housing, education, healthcare, and transportation. Since 2010, Brooklyn Park population has grown by 14%, and it's one of the most diverse cities in the state, with 61 of the Brooklyn Park residents identifying as African Americans or Black, Asians, Latinos or Hispanics, or non-white. I'm here today testifying because I want to make sure the voices of my neighbors are heard in the local and the state government. I want to make sure the redistricting process results in equitable representation, which ultimately will reflect the policies passed to support the people in our state, especially people in Brooklyn Park, where we worked so hard, and in Hennepin County, to make sure the historically undercounted people were counted. So we made sure we changed the narrative of historically undercounted people were all counted in the 2022 census. Thank you for the opportunity. And if there is any question, I will be glad to answer if I'm able.
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you for your hard work and good work for getting so many people to answer the census. That's really important to all of Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. Thank you very much. The next person is Carter Yost, president of the College Dems.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I hope you're all well. And thank you for allowing me a chance to speak with you today.
And please introduce yourself.
Yeah, my name is Carter.
Where you live?
I use pronouns like he, him, and his. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I live on the West Bank campus over in Minneapolis. And I'm currently the state president for the College Democrats of Minnesota. In that position, I work with over a dozen college chapters across campuses across our state. And I'm here today to represent our perspective, and to speak as and on behalf of students and young people in Minnesota who believe in the need and importance for fair and equitable redistricting. There are a great deal of college campuses in Minnesota's 5th District, comprising a population of thousands and thousands of students. As the process of redistricting continues, I urge this committee to place intentional focus on preserving and protecting the fair representation of students and young people. As the lines get drawn and the maps get made, we must ensure that college campuses and the communities which house them are kept complete within single districts as much as possible. We cannot afford to split these communities or dilute their representation by cutting campuses in half between state legislative lines. The current maps in Minnesota's 5th, all things considered, do a fairly good job of achieving this goal, and I hope this committee maintains that trend for this next cycle. Especially given the rapid growth of population in the Minneapolis metro area, it is critical that any given college campus stays within a single district whenever and wherever possible. Prioritizing the representation of students is, of course, good for students, and I will admit I am probably biased there to some extent, but it's important to remember that what is good for students is ultimately what's good for all of us, and I'm sure as elected officials in the state, you all believe that as well. Minnesota is home to some of the strongest voter turnout rates in the country. Last election, our state ranked first in youth turnout, first in the nation. That was us. And a major cause of what I think is truly a remarkable result there, from my perspective as the state chair for College Democrats of Minnesota, and just my perspective as a young voter, is the effect of a belief that, at least to some extent, that the electoral system works or is worth engaging with and caring about and participating in. And that's fantastic. But I will tell you this, both as a fact and as a warning. If this redistricting process leads to split college communities or brazenly partisan gerrymandering, the apathy and the scope of disinterest we will see from young people will increase dramatically. And that's bad for all of us. It is bad for everybody if young people decide this system just isn't worth it. And the fastest track to a Minnesota where young people give up and don't care is a Minnesota where young people are made to believe that their vote doesn't count or their voice doesn't matter. The decision this committee makes and the final result of this redistricting process will shape the next decade of our political system. By the time we begin this process again, a third of my entire life will have been lived under the effects of these maps and districts. Madam Chair and members of this committee, what we have here is an obligation to recognize students as a community of interest and an opportunity to demonstrate to ourselves and to people across the country that even with a split partisan legislature, we are still able to roll up our sleeves, work together, and fight for fair and equitable redistricting in Minnesota. This is our chance to invest and support the young people who live, work, learn, and vote here. I urge you to consider the voices of students in this state and in this district, and I look forward to a final map that recognizes the value in preserving the political power of young people. Thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I hope everybody's hanging in there. Cheers.
Are the student, Mr. Yost, are the students going to stay for 10 years?
Well, you hope so. And part of how you make sure that people stay here is that they feel like they're wanted here. And part of how you make sure people feel they're wanted here is that their vote counts, their voice counts, that it's worth investing in the state and in the system. You know, when people have politicians and policies that they feel represent them and that they feel serve them, people want to stay where that is, where that's true. And that's not true in a whole lot of the country. But it can be true here, and I think it is true here in many places. But this redistricting process can swing that either way. So people who are here for 2, 4, or 8 years might stay here for the rest of their lives. It's dependent upon, to some extent, what we do here. And so it's why I think it's so important that we recognize those voices, both for people who are in college now, for people who are 6 and certainly didn't come to testify today, but will still vote, or people who are 10 will still vote, you know, in maps that are drawn this cycle. So that's why I think it's so important.
Good job, Mr. Yost. Good job. Representative Bonner.
Yes, I just want to say thank you to Mr. Yost for talking about the real value of having young people at the table in the democratic process. I think most of us here are extremely proud of the fact that when we talk about Minnesota as being number one in the country for voter participation, that's a pretty incredible distinction. And it isn't this just this last cycle. Historically, we have been leaders in the nation. We once slipped to number two, but can tell you that we were able to redeem ourselves once again. And, you know, I think the really beautiful part of what you're saying here is that we have students at the University of Minnesota, at our colleges and universities around Minnesota that come from all different walks of life, all different ideologies. They represent very diverse communities from rural to urban to suburban. But going to college is a place where we find our voice, right? We find ourselves. And to start that habit early and to build that civic engagement at a grassroots level at a very early age, so that even if those individuals go back to their home communities across the state, that they are engaged, that they are listening, that they are active, is really an incredible legacy to leave. So I really applaud you for that effort, and thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you. And I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Yost. We appreciate your advice.
Thanks.
And we'll consider it as we go on. The next person's Kashi Bang, Minneapolis.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, and now we see you too.
Awesome, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming.
Good afternoon, Nyozhong. My name is Pashi Vang. I identify as a young cisgender, second generation Hmong American. I use she, her pronouns. I grew up in North Minneapolis. I now live in South Minneapolis, sort of in there. And I was very excited to work on my first 2020 census within my ethnic and geographic community. As part of my job with the Hennepin County, we had a texting campaign to reach out to Latino, Somali, and Hmong families. For me, I just want to share a highlight of the story within that campaign was that I was able to help a Hmong family of more than 10 people complete their census. They had been waiting for a long time for someone to reach out to them and would most likely have been missed if not for our comprehensive campaigns to reach historically undercounted communities. You know, they mentioned someone was supposed to reach out to them and they were, you know, anticipating the outreach, but never got that. And so I was really, you know, thankful and appreciated my call and you know, helping them and go through the census and filling it out for them. So I just want to say I did my part to make sure my community was counted. And I want to make sure that there is a fair representation of communities within these redistricting maps. And I wanted to leave that you all with that we've made our voices heard by being counted in the census through voting in elections. And I think it makes sense to make a full circle of our power in all of these systems by making sure that we're always included in these conversations, especially around redistricting. That is all. Thank you so much for your time. I'm open to answering any questions or receiving any comments.
Thank you very much, Pashi. Appreciate it a lot. Second generation. Thank you for your advice. We will consider it as we progress. Christina Doan.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Please identify yourself and where you're from.
Good afternoon.
And who you represent, because you represent a group, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Christina Doan, and I am the Director of Public Policy at CAPI USA. I'm a resident of St. Louis Park, but I work in Brooklyn Center, and I'm here today to make sure my community and communities of color are represented in this redistricting process. I ask that you consider the communities of interest that our organization has identified as you determine the redistricting principles you will utilize to draw our new district lines. For nearly 40 years, CAPI has served thousands of immigrants, refugees, and communities of color through our two multi-service centers in Brooklyn Center and Minneapolis. Over 60% of the people that we serve identify as Hmong and or Southeast Asian, and most of them whom utilize our food shelf and belong to our senior and caregiver groups. Recently, we brought together several of our Hmong participants who live in Brooklyn Center and North Minneapolis to collectively map and identify points of community interest and talk about issues such as education and water quality. During our mapping sessions, we learned that points of interest, such as the Sun Foods supermarket and our CAPI food shelf in Brooklyn Center, Park Center High School in Brooklyn Park, and Farview Park in North Minneapolis, overlap for many Hmong residents living in these three cities. These places are important to Hmong residents living in CD5 and CD3, and we believe community inclusion is a vital part of redistricting. We will share the maps CAPI developed through community support with this committee. We ask that you keep the Hmong community in the Northwest suburbs together. As a nonprofit organization that serves this community, we know how important it is for the community to stay together and be able to have the fair opportunity of electing the candidates of their choice that have shared values and will truly keep communities of interest in mind. The Hmong community is family oriented, and should the community be split, it will negatively impact the community and their voices. From Highway 55 to 85th Avenue North and from Highway 94 to West Broadway Avenue, the Hmong community gathers, plays sports in the major parks, shops in the local Asian grocery stores, and raise their families in this area. We respectfully urge this committee to ensure the drawing of district lines is transparent, accessible to our communities, and reflects our growing diverse communities. We also encourage this committee to host more public hearings, perhaps on a weekend or in the evening, so that more people can participate in this important process. On behalf of CAPI, thank you for the opportunity to engage with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Doan, I'm wondering if you guys also work with other immigrants to help identify other communities of interest within the area?
Ms. Doan.
Thank you for that question, Representative Vang. Currently, we are working with many API residents in the Northwest suburbs, as well as in Ramsey County and CD4, but we are also in partnership with many organizations who are working with many immigrant refugee communities, such as the East and West African community, to make sure the communities in the Brooklyns are also counted.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if you would please, a little more slowly, give me the addresses that you, I started to type them and then I lost the last two street addresses. So if you would please repeat those, I would appreciate it.
55 was one of them.
Right, Highway 55.
That's all I got.
Highway 55 up to 85th Avenue North and from Highway 94 over to West Broadway Avenue. And we will share our maps with the committee.
Yeah, I heard that you would share the maps. I just wanted to look at it later this evening when we have a break. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Doan. Appreciate your input and advice. Weekends and when we should have meetings? You said weekends and
evenings.
Weekends and evenings.
I know this time might be inaccessible for our community members who are working during this time.
Thank you. Yes, we'll consider. Next is Sean Loudon. Minneapolis.
Hello, Chair.
Good. Good afternoon. Thank you. Will you identify yourself and where you're from and proceed?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Murphy and representatives. My name is Sean Layden, and I live in the Whittier neighborhood of Minneapolis with my wife. We're both Minneapolis public school educators, and I'm testifying today to ask the committee to ensure that our Minneapolis Public Schools community stays represented within one congressional district. Our public school system serves the entire geography of the city of Minneapolis, and it is critical that we keep our district's boundaries within one congressional district to ensure consistent advocacy on our critical issues. Advocating with one U.S. representative allows constituencies to have a clear line of accountability for who is responsible for advocating for our education and related priorities and needs in Washington. Keep it short and just say I hope the committee will keep this important community of interest together in redistricting efforts. Thank you.
So, Mr. Layden, your advice is that the Minneapolis School District should all be in one congressional district with just one congressperson.
Correct, yes.
Is that different from the present situation?
No, it is not.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming and testifying about something you feel so strongly about. Mr. Mohammed, Minneapolis. Or maybe it's Miss.
Madam Chair, he was on the call earlier, but I don't see him now.
Okay, we might have the opportunity to call him back. So the next person then is Jaylani Tucson.
And Madam Chair, I believe the Jaylani and Salah are both unavailable, and they're working on submitting an alternate testimony.
Okay. How about Flaka May Paye?
And Madam Chair, I believe she was making an effort to be here, but at this point, I don't see her on the call.
Matt Shearer?
And Matt is not available. He will submit written testimony.
Okay. Oh. Well, committee members, anything that you heard from the testifiers so far that gave us so much good advice today that you want to react to or think comment on with the other committee members? Or does anyone wish we were including today something that we missed today? Okay. So, Ms. Conley, the people that have contacted you that are still on the agenda but have not yet testified, do you have the impression that they're going to try to be here before 5 o'clock?
Madam Chair, I do not believe that that Jaylani and Salah will be, and I don't know for certain about the last person, but we can accept a written testimony.
Yes. And Representative Cleburne, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just wonder, since we have a little extra time today, if Mr. Gehring might be willing to go through the timeline, both for the people who have tuned in for this congressional district, and then maybe again later for those who tune in for the next congressional district at a later time.
What good idea, Representative. It's a good example why you're vice chair. That's a good point. Mr. Gehring, what do you think about Representative Cleghorn's suggestion?
Madam Chair, yes, I'm happy to go through the timeline if you'd like.
All right.
Sure. I'll share my screen. It's not a very long presentation that I have. I'm just going to highlight the handout that's in your committee packet. Much of this is information you've seen previously. The big deadline that you all know about is February 15th of 2022. That's the time in law that expects the expected date in law for the legislature to complete the redistricting process for both congressional and legislative districts.
But that means that the maps have been accepted by the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, and the governor has signed it, right?
Madam Chair, that's correct, yes.
Okay.
You see some new dates on this chart that the committee hasn't discussed previously that I added here just to highlight the fact that there is local redistricting that will happen after the work of this committee is done. So at the end of March in 2022, there'll be a deadline for local governments to reestablish or redraw precinct boundaries. And then in late April of 2022, there's a deadline for local government election districts to be redistricted as well. And those are required to wait until after the legislature has completed its redistricting process. So keep in mind as you go forward that you're sort of setting up the next stage of redistricting, which will happen at the local level. And I won't go through the rest of the chart here, but the other dates, because many of them you're familiar with, but I just wanted to highlight those two items on there for those who might be watching from home that aren't aware of the local process. The second page of this handout just gives a little bit more detail about the way the legislative process works. So the committee's responsibility here is to draw and propose district boundaries for legislative and congressional districts, as you know, and also to adopt principles that will be used that are the guidelines for drawing those districts. But then there are also standards and principles in state law that govern the way counties and local governments draw their districts. And I've highlighted in the bullet points here some sites that might be useful to people watching from home to learn more about that process. And Madam Chair, that's all I have for my portion of the presentation. As I said earlier, there's no specific deadlines that apply for each congressional district. They all apply statewide, at least as far as the state law is concerned. There may be other requirements or procedures in city charters and other local ordinances, but as far as the state law goes, this is the scope of deadlines and procedures that will apply.
And the local units of government and local level things, they are sent the deadlines that they have. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, so they'll receive census data, I believe, from the state demographer, and we'll have to work with their own council and local officials to sort of understand and comply with these deadlines. But there's no specific communication that comes from the legislature to local governments about the process.
Right, but it comes from the demographer, then, this Department of Administration.
Yes, I believe that's correct, yes. Okay. I don't know if Mr. Guthrie is still on, but he could confirm that.
Do you have any other questions of Mr. Gehring? Oh, Ms. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gehring, for your information today. You know, my question is one you may or may not be able to answer, but given the fact that normally we would have tried to pass maps during a regular session, and in the event that that was not accomplished, that the panel of judges would then kind of take over their own process and draw the final map in many of the past decades, how do you see the timing of our work in relationship to what the panel of judges, which has been appointed, is doing, and how might you see us as a committee best having some effect on the final maps should we be unable to get them through the legislative process in a timely fashion? And just, I guess the question would be, what would be timely? How soon would, what would be our would you see as our goal for getting a map passed and signed in order to have get ahead of the judges, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how to put that, Mr. Gehring, but I think we're all kind of thinking about that. And if you could give us any light onto how that might all work out, I would thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gehring.
Thank you. And thank you for smiling when you said that. Mr. Gehring, do you have a smile back? And that's good.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I don't know that particular advice for you, other than to say that the court panel process has already begun. They've already issued an order, a scheduling order that indicates that they'll be conducting some public hearings in October. So presumably they'll receive input at that time from members of the public and begin some of the work of the redistricting process. Historically, the court panels that have been seated in the past have been very deferential to the legislative process. So I wouldn't expect that this panel, assuming they conform to past practices, would issue any new districts until that February 15th date. And they're usually pretty careful in their orders to indicate that this really is a constitutional process of the legislature, and that the court panel is not the primary driver of the process. So I would assume that they would follow that practice this time around and wait for you all to enact boundaries, whether it's this fall or winter, up until that February 15th date.
Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gehring. And this is our genuine dilemma with this committee. Our goal, of course, is to pass maps from both bodies, a map that matches and is signed by the governor, and that the legislature does its job of drawing these maps and getting them in place by February 15th. And you are absolutely right. We will not see any product from those judges, from that panel, until February 15th. Because they're going to give us every opportunity to do that. But the reality of the situation, in my mind at least, is that we're going to see a parallel process going on here where, and it's obvious from the fact that the judges are going to be taking testimony in October. So part of our work should be, in my mind, to try and have some influence both on our own work and perhaps also on the ongoing work of the five judges. Thank you, Mr. Gehring, and thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to speak a little bit. Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Guthrie.
Yes, I just wanted to respond to and clarify. Mr. Gehring had asked about the availability of data and where it's coming from. And I just wanted to mention that the data comes from the Census Bureau, and we do our best to make it available. And it is on our website currently, the data for redistricting. And also later in September, the Census Bureau will be sending data directly to the redistricting committees as well, but the State Demographic Center has already made those data available on our website to the best of our ability, and in a more user-friendly format than was provided at this point from the Census Bureau.
Okay, and then by September 31st, we're going to also receive another batch, right? That's more user-friendly than this.
Exactly. You are correct. It will be the exact same data, just easier to use.
Okay. That's good to know. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a question for Mr. Gehring, and being new here wasn't around 10 years ago, but I know that we got, in the past, there's been there hasn't been a concurrent process because we've gotten the data a little bit, like we got data late this year. So can you just clarify when, 10 years ago, when we got the census data and got a chance to start with our work, and when we got it this year?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, yes, so the typical process, and this is reflected on that handout that I have for the committee this time, the typical expected receipt of the redistricting data would be in late winter, early spring, so by April 1st of the year ending in one. So we would normally have expected the data to arrive April 1st of this year, or likely a few weeks prior to that here in Minnesota. And we actually received the data on August 12th of this year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And I know that this is an issue that, frankly, every state in the country is dealing with because of the delay in the census data. And so I'm grateful that we have been actively, since we got the data, doing hearings and our work as fast as possible. But I think we are all in a situation, and as is the courts, that we just lost 4 months because of the census data delay. So appreciate the clarification and appreciate the hard work of this committee.
Representative Torkelson.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Your comment, just before your last comment, was in that we should be. Should we be discussing how we can influence the courts through our committee?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for that question. I think it's, you know, first off, I think it's important to remember that Minnesota's approach to redistricting is, I believe, different than any other state in that we have this kind of a process by which if the legislature fails to get a map, that a panel of judges creates the final map. Because of that, you know, this timing affects Minnesota differently than it affects other states across our union. And it's just a question that's been on my mind and I think should be on all of our minds as we move forward. I don't propose or purport to have the answer to that question, Madam Chair.
Yeah. I didn't think that you did have the answer, but I wanted to hear more from you.
Well, I just think it's worth thinking about in relation to our work and in relation to the timing of our work. It's complicated this year because of the late release of the data, and it's going to be a little different. And I think I'm just trying to be transparent with those that might be listening to our hearings that we are in an unusual circumstance and that we as a committee recognize that this is an unusual circumstance and see how perhaps we can adjust our work in a way that accommodates everyone to the best possible.
Oh, did you make a magnetic sound?
Representative New, you're unmuted.
Chair Murphy, just for your information, Mr. Mohammed is now on the call.
Okay, let's just wait a minute and let Representative Torkelson finish. And are there other hands up on this issue?
Madam Chair, I can just throw in one.
Mr. Gary.
If you'd like, just as an observation about the practice in previous decades, 10 years ago, the House Redistricting Committee did submit to the core panel the committee records that it develops through its course of public hearings, such as this one. And so that's an option for this committee. I assume the court would accept that again this time around if you'd submitted the written comments and testimony in the committee record you've developed. There's no guarantee or particular deference that a court panel is likely to give to the committee's work compared to anyone else. But 10 years ago, the court panel did note in the order that established the new districts that the House committee did submit records and materials, and they cited that as part of their order. So that is one avenue you could consider if you're interested in engaging with the court panel process.
Thank you for that, Ed, and appreciate it. But let's let Representative Torkelson continue with his advice to us and to think about this.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
He's on a good roll here.
Well, that brings up another question for Mr. Gehring. Did that material submitted to the judges from the committee, did that include maps, and did it include multiple maps?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe it included the work of the committee that came through the public hearing process, as well as the map that was approved and recommended by the House committee to the House floor and then submitted to the governor. I don't recall whether there were multiple maps submitted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. I apologize a bit for thinking out loud, Madam Chair, but I do think these are important questions that we should be thinking about as our committee work moves forward.
And I think everybody on the committee appreciates it and thinks that it is important work, and we do want to hear it. Okay, let's revert to the list of testifiers for the 5th District now. Mr. Muhammad.
Good afternoon, Chair Murphy, members of the committee. My apologies for not being on time. I ended up getting pulled to a different meeting unexpectedly. So
to all of us, and we have time for you now, and we are ready to listen to you. Please identify yourself and who you're representing and where you live.
Awesome. So my name is Abdulaziz Muhammad. I'm the student body president at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, representing over 35,000 plus undergraduate students, and I live in the 5th Congressional District. In 2018, the University of Minnesota recorded the highest student voter turnout amongst the largest U.S. colleges, with nearly 60% of students voting. A similar record was shattered in 2020, when the University of Minnesota had a conference-leading voting rate amongst Big Ten institutions. While the high voter turnout reflects young folks' willingness to be a part of the political process, it also underscores students' confidence that district lines are drawn fairly. As such, I ask that when you make crucial decisions about redistricting, that you make sure to engage with University of Minnesota student leaders, particularly as it relates to keeping the lines in a way that keeps student communities surrounding campus together. Consulting with students is a key way to ensure that you're representing and prioritizing their interests in this process. If you have any questions or would like to discuss ways of partnering with student leaders, feel free to reach out to my organization, the Minnesota Student Association, the Undergraduate Student Government at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to talking to all of you very soon.
Mr. Muhammad, are you speaking for the Twin Cities and the students on Twin Cities campuses? Or are you speaking of all the University of Minnesota campuses?
So I'm speaking from my capacity as student body president at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. So the undergraduate population of 35,000 plus, that's the capacity in which I'm speaking with the committee at this time.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification.
No problem.
Questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Are any of the other participants available? Does any other committee member have comments to make? If not, on anything that refers to our redistricting agenda today, or in the future. All right, if not, then we are in recess until 7 o'clock p.m. Wednesday, August 25th, redistricting committee met at 2 o'clock and recessed at 4:30, and we are now over with the recess and back to the remote hearing at 7 o'clock, in which time we are going to have the listening session that refers to the 4th Congressional District of Minnesota 2021. This is our second listening session. We posted the meeting over 2 weeks ago to give more public notice than usual. This is a critical component of our work, and we value the perspectives each person offers. We welcome input from all Minnesotans, and the directions for how to give us input is on the House Redistricting Committee website. We are holding hearings at a variety of times to reach a wider range of people. We acknowledge that no schedule fits every person, so if people are not available to participate via Zoom or during these times, the option to submit written testimony is provided. Nancy Conley is our committee administrator and is always prepared to receive additional written documentation for testimony. We would like to receive the money and the information before the committee date, but if that is impossible, we will still accept written testimony for committee consideration through the end of September. The purpose of these public input sessions is for members to listen to what the public has to say. Unless it is for purposes of a clarification or commendation, let's try to hold our comments so we can hear everyone who wants to testify. We are scheduled to adjourn at 9 o'clock, but with the number of people that are testifying, perhaps we will conclude before that time. But before we start hearing testimony from the public, Dr. Guthrie from the State Demographer's Office, and he's the senior demographer for the state of Minnesota. He will give a brief summary of demographic changes that have taken place in Congressional District 4. And after Dr. Guthrie's presentation, Mr. Gehring will again talk about the timeline differences. Dr. Guthrie, you're on.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. I appreciate your introduction. And just as a note, while I get my slides on the screen, some of the slides that I'll be presenting this evening will be a repeat of what I gave in the last district presentation. So if there is a time crunch, please let me know and I can skip those. But I think that some of the information will be valuable to the public. So if there isn't, then I will go through them all. But
Dr. Guthrie, I don't believe that there is a time crunch this evening.
Wonderful. And again, thank you to the committee for inviting me to speak, and we will just get into it. The first illustration that I'd like to provide to the group, it looks at the percent change in the most basic political units across the state of Minnesota. So we are looking at cities and townships, and I'm providing a percent change view of the state because if we were to look at just numeric change, the only thing that would be highlighted would be our population centers and our metropolitan areas. And I think that it's important to look at population change more broadly. Now, of course, our metropolitan areas and especially the Twin Cities region has seen the most numeric change from 2010 through 2020, but vast areas of the state have seen population increases, and those are also important. And this graphic has been shown by our state demographer, Dr. Brower, in the past, but I think that it shows that broad areas of our state have seen population increases. And when we talk about population change in Minnesota, we are not just talking about increases in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Now, when I bring up Oh, and I always have this issue on my first slide when I try to change slides. There we go. Sorry. When I bring up District 4, we can see that District 4 has had a mix of population increases and population declines, and I will zoom in on that area. This shows that, our larger cities have mostly seen a good bit of population increase. There are a couple of exceptions. And we also have to recognize that when we're talking about population increases and declines, there have also been boundary changes over the decade, which may account for some of the population decline. So, for example, when we're looking at District 4, we see the darkest population decline indicator, that darkest yellow, kind of a buff color up in the upper, the northeastern corner of the district, that is Stillwater Township, right? Not Stillwater City, but Stillwater Township. And if there has been, for example, some orderly annexations or something like that, that has decreased the size of a particular township moving that area into a city, that may be, accounting for some of the population decline for a particular area. There also have been some cities, Lauderdale saw some population decline. But broadly speaking, when we look at the breadth of the district, we see that there has been population increases. Now, personally, I live in this particular district. I live in St. Paul, and we can see that St. Paul has seen some population increases, not the largest population increases in the district, but still some population increases. And those increases and declines have been spread differently across the districts. But overall, the district has seen some population increases, and I think that's valuable to recognize. Aside from just the raw percent increases, I think it's also vital to look at disaggregated populations and how those have changed between 2010 and 2020. Now, overall, the district has increased by about 9.6% over the period. But our largest population increases, as you can see, the sum of the race category has increased by considerable amount, by a considerable amount, by 236%, and so has our multiple race category by 96%. I'm going to talk about in a moment how definitional changes may be affecting that those particular groups. But what we're seeing is increases in our demographic groups other than the white group. We can see in this particular table that the white non-Hispanic group has actually declined in the fourth district between 2010 and 2020. When we think about what could have caused population increases and population declines, aside from the actual movement of persons, we also have to consider changes in the manner in which data were collected. There have been changes to the race and ethnicity questions since 2010. 2020 allowed for more opportunities for individuals to write in racial and ethnic groups. And this is not just for non-white groups. The white group for the first time has also had an opportunity to write in detailed ethnic groups as well. And there has also been larger spaces and an ability to write in more groupings other than just the standard classification. So that has helped to really paint a better picture of how individuals view themselves. And what this has allowed us to do is see that we are actually a more multiracial society than previous data has been able to show. And I think that is a valuable thing to take from these data. And while that changing of definitions is not solely responsible for the changes in the data, as I mentioned, there have been movements of persons. We have seen corresponding increases in those some other race and multiple race categories, which really points to a more nuanced view that people are allowed to express in these data that they have not necessarily had an opportunity to express in previous censuses. So I think that is a valuable element. And then it's also some background for some of the stories that we have been seeing in the media recently with regard to the changing demographics of the nation and the changing demographics of our state. When we think about other data considerations, I do need to point out, obviously, that this census was conducted during a worldwide pandemic, and that did require the Census Bureau to make several adjustments to their operational plans. However, even with those adjustments that had to be made on the fly, without planning, obviously, the Census Bureau has indicated that they were able to close in excess of 99% of all of their cases. So even with the challenges, we believe that we have good quality data to do our redistricting and to get us through the next decade in terms of all of our planning and whatever else we need to use these census data for. In addition to the worldwide pandemic that was ongoing during the conducting of our census, we also had some unprecedented uncertainty regarding certain aspects of the census. This, as I mentioned, was even before the pandemic, and that caused concern in individuals' willingness to respond to the census. But again, the census has indicated that they were able to close in excess of 99% of all cases with regard to, and when I talk about cases, I'm talking about individuals that did not respond to the census and that had to go to the field for people to actually go to knock on doors. So even in that circumstances, the vast majority of cases were able to be closed with data having been collected. This census will also be the first census that will introduce a new disclosure avoidance system that the Census Bureau has implemented called differential privacy. And this will provide enhanced protection for respondents' confidentiality to make sure that even with the increases in available computing power and new techniques, that respondents' confidentiality will be maintained both presently and moving into the future. It is something that we need to be aware of, however, because what this process does is infuse noise at all levels, but most importantly at the smallest levels, which the block level, which our districts will be built out of. However, when we aggregate these small geographies into larger geographies, that noise tends to cancel out, and we get good quality data that the Census Bureau has certified will be fit for the redistricting use case. I'm sorry if I talk very quickly, but if anybody has any questions on anything that I have talked about, I'd be more than happy to entertain those questions and to help everybody understand the data as it's published.
All right. Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Guthrie, for your presentation. My question deals with the fact that people self-identify for race, and we've changed a number of the questions in the census regarding race. Is it possible that some of these percentage changes are really reflecting changes in the way people report rather than actual changes in the population?
Yes.
Dr. Guthrie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is a definite possibility, but I think that what we're seeing is an ability for people to better find themselves in the questions, right? So people have been self-identifying racial and ethnic identities since the Census Bureau started mailing out questionnaires, so back to the 1950s. Now, granted, at that time, they had less ability to really get granular in their identification. So it was either in 1990 or 2000 where people were first able to check multiple racial categories. Prior to that, they could only check one. So as we have moved across time, people have been able to better express what they feel their identity is. But I think the crux of your question is, are we seeing shifts because people are able to better find themselves in the question? And I think the answer is yes. And I think that that is seen in the expansion and the growth of the sum of the race and the multiple race categories.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Tarkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Guthrie. I have no idea how, I don't know if anybody's looked at how much impact there's been. Is there also the possibility that we've done a much better job of getting the ethnic population to actually respond at all to the census?
Yes. I'm going to say more, but I could stop at that, because the short answer is Minnesota did a fantastic job of responding and outreach. And I think that, we have heard members of the BIPOC communities, the communities of color, and various interest groups talk to how much work they have done to get people to respond to the census and to get people to respond in a very complete way.
Any other questions of Dr. Guthrie? Well, thank you for that wonderful summary.
Yes, ma'am.
And for the pictures.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Mr. Matt Gehring, House Research.
Madam Chair, members, just for the record, Matt Gehring from House Research. I'm the nonpartisan staff for this committee. I'm just going to share my screen and show you the timeline that you looked at in the previous session of this committee. I'm just going to highlight a couple of dates on here for those that may be joining for the evening session. The most significant date for the purposes of this committee is the February 15th date that you see here. This is the date that the law expects that the legislature will have completed the work of enacting new legislative and congressional district boundaries. And that date would require that not just that the committee has passed the bill, but that the legislature has fully enacted a bill and the governor has signed it by that date. That's the expected date provided in statute. You'll see on this table that there are other dates as well. The pieces that I've added here that are new to this committee as of today are the dates that relate to local redistricting. So keep in mind that the work that you all are doing as committee members are for the legislative and congressional district boundaries for the state. But then once your work is complete, all of the political subdivisions, so counties, cities, school districts, et cetera, will have to do their own reestablishment of district boundaries and reestablishment of ward boundaries as needed. And there are dates listed here for when that work must be completed. The key dates there are the March 29th, 2022 date for reestablishing municipal precinct and ward boundaries, and April 26th of 2022 for other election districts at the local government level. And as we talked about in the previous session, the data that the local governments will use for this work will be available through the website of the state demographer and can be accessed right now so that work can begin. The second page, I'll just let you kind of read through the rest of the timeline. Most of the other dates here are fairly straightforward. The second page of this handout just provides some basic background on the redistricting process and how it works. So as you all of you know, the legislature is responsible by the state constitution for enacting legislative and congressional district boundaries. That work includes adopting principles. So principles are the standards that the committee would use to decide how the lines should be drawn. And then there are separate state laws that apply to the work of counties, cities, towns, and school districts. And I've just by bullet point here to sort of highlighted those topics and citations to the laws that would apply in those situations if people need them. And Madam Chair, I think I'll leave it there and happy to answer questions if anyone has them.
Thank you. I don't see any questions at this time. So thank you, Dr. Guthrie, and thank you, Mr. Gehring. We have five people signed up to testify, plus some written testimony that was provided to members and posted. As we listen, people may talk about communities of interest, and I would like to read one more time before we begin The definition that was submitted to the National Council of State Legislatures, Wendy, Underhill, presented at the National Conference of National Conference of State Legislatures and the Communities of Interest definition was presented by her, and a long discussion, I understand, by her at the convention in Utah in August. And I would like to once again, for everybody's hearing, the new people who signed up just for tonight, what is a academic but very useful definition of communities of interest. Ms. Wendy Underhill said that communities of interest, and I'm quoting her, geographical areas such as neighborhoods of a city or regions of a state where residents have common demographic and or political interests that do not necessarily coincide with the boundaries of a political subdivision, such as a city or county. Unquote. Keeping that definition in mind, we will now hear testimony from the people that signed up and received their order of presentation. From the committee administrator. The first person on the agenda is Terry Tao from St. Paul. Will you identify yourself and state whatever you want to us?
Thank you very much, Chair Murphy, and to the members of the committee. My name is Terry Tao. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a mother advocate and resident of the east side of St. Paul in Ramsey County. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you all tonight. I've lived in CD4 since I moved to Minnesota as a young child. I'm really testifying tonight because fairness is a value that we really embrace here in Minnesota. We want fairness in both access to opportunities and in the process, and that we hope it leads to positive outcomes. So if we're really truly talking about fairness, at the very minimum, we need to ensure that the redistricting process is fair and prevent gerrymandering and partisan mapping manipulation, which divides communities and prevents all Minnesotans from having a voice in our elections. Also, as part of the process of being fair, we also have to incorporate the experiences of communities of interest across the state. For me, I grew up in St. Paul as part of the secondary migration of Hmong families, who came to be with family from the original U.S. cities we were resettled in. We thrived in St. Paul because of the availability and access to affordable housing, entry-level jobs and other jobs, cheaper commercial storefronts for us to open our businesses, and the public education system, which allowed for my families like mine to thrive and grow. And it's because we were able to thrive and grow and prosper that leads us to the very census outcomes we see today that the state demographer mentioned earlier in CD4's demographic changes. So cohesive communities of interest, like the Hmong community, should be respected and reflected, and districts should not be drawn with the purpose of splitting or concentrating marginalized groups, which is not just exclusive to Hmong folks, but to our Black, Indigenous, or people of color communities, or to various racial and ethnic groups, or members of a language minority group. A representative redistricting plan must be drawn so that elected bodies reflect the diversity of a state, particularly the racial and ethnic diversity. Historic adherence to mapping ideas, such as compacting communities, is not enough to guarantee representative maps. I would also point out that sometimes the history behind some of these have been steeped in bias and unfortunately have led to some of the very negative outcomes we experience today. We need to create new maps that fairly represent the state of Minnesota and make sure the maps do not divide BIPOC communities and dilute their electoral power. We need to recognize real community boundaries where people live and shop. For example, here in the Hmong Village on the east side, and the business community, which is actually throughout the Congressional District 4. and not just follow the municipal boundaries. We can't allow the delay in census data to be an excuse for rushing to maps without public input. And I really implore you all as our legislative members to do everything within your power to reach an agreement on redistricting. It's really the fair thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I like the way you said mother. Questions? Thank you. The second, wait a minute. The second item on the agenda, or the second person who was asked to testify, is Clara Ware. Will you please identify yourself and say where you're from?
Hello, Madam Chair and everyone. This is Clara. My name is Clara Ware. I live in District 4. On the east side in Ramsey County, and I'm a housing advocate. I worked on the 2010 census at Metro State and the 2021 census with Ramsey County on the homeless committee. I did outreach to underserved and underrepresented communities of color to ensure that they are counted in the 2020 census and funded. The work was successful, and there was high participation rates in the 2021 census. Our main target was people of color who do not participate because of lack of outreach and education to the community. My shared interest would be, I'm following the questions that were sent to me in the prompt to address some of the issues that need to be addressed on the east side in District 4. So my shared interests where I live are affordable housing, education, employment. I read that again. My shared interest where I live is affordable housing, education, employment, and public safety and BIPOC community. I mean, Black, Indigenous people of color. And then in District 4, there have been many conversations with elected officials who represent my community, but there's still no access to affordable, attainable, and safe housing. Instead, there's preparatory practices, displacement, homelessness, unraveling at our very eyes. There have been no development or infrastructure in place to address these issues. As far as transit, there are no rapid transit systems rapid transit system in place to get residents to the location fast and safe. And then I'm gonna go up. What is important to my community with the 2020 census from what I'm seeing when I worked in the 2010 census with Metro State is that there is lack of funding to our communities. You know, when you do census every year, there's supposed to be funding. So 2021 census, there was a lack of funding to our community. And so what's important to my community is have affordable housing, having residents engaged in the voting and the census process, resource and ongoing yearly funding that will lift people of color out of extreme and impoverished conditions. What's important to my community, same thing. And then they asked me a question, what are the street name and significant locations and your neighborhood to help us identify the perimeters of your community and where your community is growing. From listening to him, it looks like there has been an increase in population in the Black community, about like 19% increase in the population for African American. And so I named the streets. It was the East Side, Lower Afton, Upper Afton, White Bear, Wilson Avenue, Johnson Parkway, 3rd Street, 4th Street, 5th Street.
Slow down a little bit. I go back to where you started naming the names of the streets.
So the
name slower.
Okay. So the name of the streets will be East Side, Lower Afton.
Go on.
Upper Afton.
Go on.
White Bear.
Okay.
Wilson Avenue.
Wilton?
Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N, Wilson.
Thank you.
Johnson Parkway.
Okay.
3rd Street.
Okay.
4th Street.
Go on.
5th Street.
Go on.
6th Street. 7th Street, Mariah, Ruth, and Minnehaha.
Got him.
So my I got two more questions and I'll be done. In district,
please continue.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. In District 4, community members and District 1 Council and concerned parents of a new ban met with some elected officials such as City Council Jane Prince, Superintendent of St. Paul Public School Joe Goff, and Mayor Melvin Carter to address public safety, investments in communities of color, transit conversations were held in communities by the Department of Transportation and Housing. Community members had serious conversation. There has been a lack of communication and no outreach back to communities of color. The African American communities have been left out of the political process and without any investment in resources to their community. My community needs a safety net so they can breathe. and the other question was, are there nearby areas you want to be in a district with? I figured that the district that, because I live like, what did I say, about a couple miles from Oakdale and about 5 miles from Maplewood. So what I see the difference is, Madam Chair and everyone, is that when you go those 2 miles or the 5 miles, everything looks different. You know, that looks like an investment in community. And if redistricting means that you add another, another precinct to our community in District 4, will the investment be more for people of color in that district? So that would be my concern, is how are we gonna take the census funding and invest in communities of color to make sure that these BIPOC communities are being invested in and resources are being allocated to the community? Because my last comment would be, I worked in the 2010 census at Metro State, and then when 2021 census came around, I did not see any funding or resources allocated to BIPOC communities, especially African-American communities who are at a disadvantage in our community. Uh-huh. And underserved and underrepresented. Thank you, Madam Chair, and everyone for listening to me. And I probably will send you guys these answers to the question as well, so you can have a conversation with the governor as well. Thank you for your time, everyone. Good night.
Thank you so much, Ms. Ware, and thank you for your past service to your community and to the state of Minnesota. And I'm hoping, as a member of the redistricting committee and a chair of the redistricting committee, that we can bring some changes for the positive of your hard work and your recommendations to us. We will consider your advice.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. The next person is Dr. Yanislav Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you for coming. Please
introduce
yourself and tell us about your wishes for redistricting or your advice for us.
I want to take a second then while presenting myself, I'll give you a quick history on my family. We came to the United States in 1990, 31 years ago. And this is the first time I got a chance to participate in the committee hearings, so I feel very satisfied about this opportunity. So thank you again, Madam Chair and committee members, for giving me this opportunity to do a little bit of a civic duty. Yes. I've been working for Alina Medical Clinic in Woodbury for the last 25 years, a little bit short than 25, and just recently retired. But for those long years, working as a family practice physician for Alina Medical Clinic in Woodbury, I've seen quite a few patients from Cottage Grove, from Inman Grove Heights, So my understanding is that if we're talking about demographic boundaries, they're very porous between, say, Woodbury, that is a fourth district, fourth congressional district, and say, Cottage Grove, that is a second congressional district. I see their families. I see that kids are interested in coming to Woodbury to participate in various extracurricular activities. My colleagues who work with me are also from Cottage Grove. So I think that from that angle, there is really a good degree of interpenetration, interconnection between those two areas, namely Woodbury and Cottage Grove. To a lesser degree, but still, we see similar situation with Inver Grove Heights. And all in all, I think that if redistricting will take place, Woodbury and Cottage Grove should be seen as very close and very interrelated as cities. Well, that's basically what I wanted to tell the committee on that account. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much for your experience. Thank you for your contributions to Minnesota in 31 years, and we appreciate very much that you chose Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for participating in this process for the first time. And who knows, it might be the beginning of community activism for the doctor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. The next person on the agenda is Dr. Bruce Corey. Please identify yourself and tell us where you live and what advice you have for the redistricting committee members.
Good evening, Chair Murphy and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I live in St. Paul. I'm an economist with the ALANA Brain Trust, and that stands for African, Latino, Asian, and Native American. In this testimony, I draw from and is supported by members of the ALANA Brain Trust who have been thinking and talking about redistricting. And these include Brett Buckner, who is managing director of 1MN.org, Anastasia Belladonna Carrera from Common Cause, Roy Taylor, Pamela Standing, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Indigenous Business Alliance, Jane Leonard, who is the president of Growth and Justice, and myself. In beginning, I must say I really appreciate your warm, welcoming environment and tone of this meeting, which is good for us citizens engaging in the process. I would take the suggestion of Administrator Connolly to share my screen to show off some of the written portions of my testimony that might be helpful. I estimate that the ALANA African, Latino, Asian, Native American economy is of an estimated $1.4 trillion, which is basically bigger than the economy of Mexico. And this estimate includes the lifetime earnings and talent of our communities, our workers. It includes our businesses, residential real estate, and rental payments of tenants. And I estimate that this economy generates at least $3 billion in annual state and local taxes to Minnesota. And in each of these last redistricting in 2001 and 2010, and we have raised and testified on the need for adequate political representation of these economic interests. The imbalance of power continues through these 20 years and is reflected in an estimated $287 billion racial economic gap in Minnesota. Today, the ALANA population is estimated to be 24% of the total population of Minnesota, or over 1.35 million people. So if adequate political representation and power sharing were to occur, there would be at least 16 Alana senators and 32 Alana representatives in the Minnesota legislature. This, unfortunately, is not the case. So why is this political representation important? First, this economy, which is bigger than the economy of Mexico, needs political representation to preserve and grow. If done right, the global networks of the Alana communities and the local talent of its workforce and youth will help grow the Minnesota economy and tap into new global markets, technology, and resources, bringing jobs, income, wealth to all Minnesotans, as was just shared by the previous testifier. This potential remains untapped, especially over the last 20 years. One of the barriers to effective political participation is the difference in the lived experiences of the Alana communities and those who are not of the Alana communities, especially elected and appointed leaders. As such, there is an inability of these elected and appointed leaders to understand the issues and opportunities the Alana critical mass of Alana elected and appointed leaders will ensure that barriers to effective political participation is removed. And third, our observation, especially in the most recent legislative session in Minnesota, was that when Alana leaders had power, they were most successful in securing meaningful solutions and opportunities to address the huge racial disparities in Minnesota. So shared governance matters. And when we look at the fourth congressional districts and the sub-governments within it, we find that the Alana economy in this congressional district is an estimated $280 billion, which in relative terms is bigger than the economy of Finland. So while the Alana communities have made progress in political power in pockets across this district, overall, there's still an imbalance of political power. The Alana communities make up 38% of the population of this congressional district. And this implies that the possibility of implementing policies and programs that benefit the Alana community is quite high. Unfortunately, racial disparities remain very high in this congressional district, and so also in Congressional District 5 that you recently heard testimony about. So when I put the table below, you'll find that in a number of districts, for your information, especially 6, 7, and 8, the Alana populations has moved to double-digit representation. And so there's all the more need for proper attention to make sure that the Alana voice is not diluted and that there is adequate opportunity districts for political power to emerge. So I would like to offer some redistricting principles for you to keep in mind as you think through the process. First, do no harm to Alana communities. Current political victories by Alana candidates derives from a core base of Alana supporters and partnership with other communities, and it's important to preserve these communities of interest. In my testimony in 2001, I made the case to preserve Congressional District 4 based on this notion of these communities of interest, as our first testifier, Terry Tao, so adequately brought to the for the communities of interest around the Hmong community. The second is to grow opportunity Alana opportunity districts, such to enable at least 24% of the Minnesota House and Senate, as well as our congressional representation, can be elected from the Alana communities. And third, grow politically competitive districts. When you have politically competitive districts, there's a natural give and take and learning that occurs. And by increasing the amount of political districts, we are creating structurally opportunities for collaboration and listening and developing appropriate solutions. These competitive districts can be the glue that holds Minnesota together around shared sustainable prosperity for all. So thank you very much for this opportunity to testify, and I look forward to continue to engage with the process as it moves forward.
And what is Alana?
It just stands for African, Latino, Asian, and Native American.
Yes.
It's the same as people use BIPOC or people of color. I try to move away from the color because color has been the foundation of the exploitation of people.
And in Alana, is there a group of people that are working to encourage your members, your people of the same interests to run for the new leadership opportunities that could be available to them?
Yes, and this has been happening quite effectively in Minnesota, and it's glad to see this process at work. But we have a statewide network, and one of the things that we do is to build capital and capacity of our communities by offering resources and solutions, just as we are intervening now in the redistricting debate to bring the wisdom of the community to the process.
Yeah. Well, you sure summarized it in your written testimony and your thoughtful presentation, and some of the things that you put together was very profound in my mind.
Thank you very much.
I might not even be able to fall asleep pretty soon. But thank you for this. No yellow hands. Okay. The last person on the agenda is Mohammed Ibrahim.
Madam Chair, he is not going to be available tonight.
He's not going to be. Oh. So, Dr. Corey was the final person that we're waiting for?
That's correct.
Okay. Comments or advice on what we've heard from the people of the 4th District, from the committee members? Vice Chair Cleburne.
Thank you very much, Chair Murphy. I would just like to thank the testifiers for coming this evening and sharing the information they have about the communities where they live. It's critical to the work that we're doing. Ms. Ware, your statements about the need to have representation that understands your housing, your healthcare, your economic issues is key to that process. And I just want to say thank you for the hard work that you did in the census and also advocating for your community. Dr. Corey, I've been fortunate enough in higher education to hear you testify numerous times, and I thank you for the insights that you always bring to us. And to Mr. Wolfson, I say thank you for both enriching our community through your medical services and caring for our families that way, but also in your willingness to come tonight to share with us. And Ms. Tao, the information that you've shared with us tonight has just been very, very helpful, and I'm so appreciative of your insights.
Thank you very much. And
the information that you've given to us to help us do our work in a fair and transparent way.
Thank you.
Okay. And thank you, Vice Chair, for your great summary. And I would like to reiterate that the information that each of you presented will make a difference and will take place. We will refer back to it in our discussions with each other and as we progress and hear what kind of things other congressional districts bring in. But I don't think we made a mistake by starting with the 5th and 4th districts, because we have faces for the two largest populated congressional districts that are now in existence in Minnesota. And it's going to be your faces and your words that we're hearing up front. So I think today brought us a long way. And what you said, each of you said, that refers to the principles that we are going to have to adopt, as well as the maps that we are going to have to draw, was a significant contribution to what our conclusions will and end product will be. and this is not going to be your last chance. So as we go down the road or tour, take our journey, your words will follow us along. And thank you very much. Is there any other business to come before this committee? If not, this meeting is adjourned.